Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay, and I'm Bulls.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of the Inkblack Heart, this time covering chapters 78 through 82 of part 4. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of the Inkblack Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we get started, there's not really a whole lot of news.
Not yet.
Not
Yeah.
yet. A couple of minor
Soon.
things here and there, but soon, yes.
Can you imagine if the cover and blurb dropped while we were recording this? That
Right?
would be
You get
amazing.
live reaction.
Oh, it'd be so good.
It probably wouldn't be good for listeners because we might blow out their eardrums or something.
No,
Right?
we can turn down the volume on the recording. It would be great.
Yeah. I kind of hope it's not dropped like that all at once. Remember with Troubled Blood, there was a lead up
There's a
to
lead up
it.
so that you get the anticipation.
Yeah. It was the clock, right? And then Rebecca on
Yes,
Twitter, she found that it was Hampton
Hampton
Court
Court.
Palace. That was so fun. I would
Yeah,
love
it
it if they did
was.
something fun like that again.
The detective work is always really fun.
We do like to be detectives.
We are fans of the genre, so I mean, it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
But what news do we have?
The Robert Galbraith account, the newsletter, they had some Cuckoo's Calling stuff. It's not a lot to talk about, but it's kind of exciting if it's leading up to that special edition that they were talking about, because I really want that.
Yeah, because they've got the 10 years of Strike and Robin thing.
Yeah. There's something I wanted to bring up. I thought it could be fun if we get enough participation. So a few episodes back, Pools, you had asked if there were any therapists who listened to the show and asked for some insight. We got a really fun response from Emily on Instagram, who basically gave us a what if scenario on how she would treat Strike and what kind of client she thought he would be. And I found it really fascinating. It was fun to read.
It was.
So I just thought that it would be fun if we got a few different opinions from a few different therapists, and maybe we can write something up for the blog.
Like a case studies kind of
Like a
thing.
Strike case study.
Yeah. Oh, that would be
Therapists weigh
so
in.
great.
Yeah, I thought it could be fun. So if you're a therapist and want to pretend like Strike is your client, let us know how you think it would go. Get in touch with us, send us an email or a DM.
Would love that. That would be so amazing.
There's just one other thing, something that I wanted to correct from last time. We got an email just this morning from Frida. In our last episode, we were talking about how Anime would know that someone's entering and exiting the game.
Yes.
She said that it does say in chapter 35 when Robin first enters the game. Meanwhile, a sidebar showed everyone who was entering and leaving the game.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, it does
So he
say that.
does know.
Just wanted to throw that out there to correct ourselves.
Oh, I am always open to being corrected.
For some reason, this book is really difficult with all those tiny little details.
It's a very complicated book.
And the fact that it's not included in certain parts doesn't help either.
What do you mean?
In the part that I was talking about, it didn't show Paperwhite entering the moderator chat. It was just her opening up a private chat because she didn't appear in the main chat.
No, I'm talking about in the main room of the game. That's where Anami saw she, well,
Well,
quote unquote.
claims to have seen, yeah.
Yeah, that's where she entered the game. So that's what he could see. Although technically, I guess he would see it. He saw himself enter the game, but not in the mod chat. It was in the outside game.
All right, fair enough.
Should we go on to our Q&A? Is this our last one?
There's one more that we haven't decided what episode we're going to put it to, but definitely one of the last ones.
I hope she'll do a new Q&A for the Running Grave.
I bet she will. Because she did one for Troubled Blood too, right?
She should come on a certain podcast and answer some Q's with some A's over here. You know what I'm saying?
I think we would have some fun cues for her A's.
We would have the best Q's. She'd give the best A's. It would be perfect.
Anyway, I really like this question.
Me too. This one's a really fun one. So the Q&A for this episode. Have fans' reactions to the Strike series ever influenced your future plans for characters?
I don't ever let fans or readers influence what I'm going to write. I just don't. And I think if readers had their way, Strike and Robin would have jumped into bed together 4 books back. But I always had this sort of journey plan for them, so I'm sorry, I'm sticking to my plan. So no, I suppose the answer is no, but I do gen I mean I love getting feedback. And I even love hearing I really love hearing, when are they going to get together? Because that shows that readers are engaged and love the characters as much as I do. So, you know, I love it. Although I think fans of that aspect of the books will get certain rich content in this one.
When I first heard this answer, I was like, thank God for that.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I don't just mean this about the things that I think are bad takes. I genuinely mean it even about things that I want to happen, but haven't happened yet, if you know what I mean. Her plan is going to be so much more amazing than anything I could ever come up with or think I wanted.
I fully agree. I've talked before about how I totally envisioned them getting together sooner. But the way that Jo has the story unfolding, it's so much better to me. It's perfect. She's taking the time to show their full journey. Mm-hmm. And she's doing it so much better than I could.
It's funny when she says that fans would have had them in bed together four books back, because that's what, Career of Evil?
Yeah.
This might be surprising, but I didn't ever actually see it happening until maybe Troubled Blood, but not really expecting it then. I think the Inkblackheart was the only time where I really thought that it was going to happen.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if it had been up to me, they would have been in bed four books back and the story would have been worse for it. I don't know when I started actually expecting it to happen, but I know I've been hoping every time.
And one last thought. I love when Jo said, I really love hearing when are they going to get together, because that shows that readers are engaged and love the characters as much as I do. Mm. First, I love this because thank God our endless desperation doesn't drive her crazy. But also, we always say that we love that Jo must love them as much as we do or more than we do. And here she's saying that exact same thing about us. It's kind of nice to know that we both feel that way.
It is nice. This particular bit that you've talked about, this quote makes me think that wanting them to get together equals loving the characters in Jo's mind, right? And we know that Jo loves the characters. Ergo, logically, she wants to get them together as badly as we do.
I like that ergo.
It's logic.
It certainly does sound like what she's saying, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe there's someone that can find the quote for me, but do you remember when she said that the relationship between Strike and Robin is what keeps people reading and it's what keeps her writing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be her favorite bit too.
I don't know how she restrains herself. How difficult must it be to actually write them missing kisses?
And well, probably because she knows exactly where it's going. She probably enjoys the setup as well, because she knows where the payoffs are going to come in.
There are no intrusive thoughts in those little moments that she writes where she's like, fuck it, we'll write a version of the scene where they kiss instead.
That's one of the questions I would ask her if we have her on. Do you have visions of alternate ways that scenes could have gone? Like, did you at some point make a choice between two versions and maybe just save that second version to yourself?
That's a fun question.
I want to know how she makes these choices for the characters, and I want to know if she's got any kisses saved on her hard drive. And if so,
can you read them?
Can I read them, please?
Should we jump into 78?
Yes, let's do it.
So in chapter 78, Strike and Robin debrief after their interview with Inigo, and Robin receives unpleasant news about the Havening.
The epigraph to chapter 78. Why should I praise thee, blissful Aphrodite? Thou dost not guide, rather with conflict dire my mind divide. And that is from a poem by Catherine Bradley and Edith Cooper. The title of this in the book is in Greek, but I believe, so this poem is from a volume of poetry called Long Ago. And this poem is in the table of contents as the first line, why should I praise thee, blissful Aphrodite, or as lyric 24. The Greek title that we see in Inkblackheart is, I believe, a fragment of Sappho, the ancient Greek poet, that translates to Sappho, why celebrate or worship most happy Aphrodite? Keep in mind, I can't read Greek letters, but I believe that that is the sort of story of the title of that poem.
This is a great epigraph. I love this one. I'm thinking that this might have to do with Strike avoiding Madeline and choosing Robin over her. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think you're right. Venus is the Roman Aphrodite. Mm-hmm. So it connects back to Tannhäuser for me, where Tannhäuser is trapped by Venus but escapes. Mm. So here, our Tannhäuser is about to make his escape. I don't know, is it too much of a stretch to read it like, why should I praise you and give you the validation when you're just dividing my mind from the thing I should be focusing on?
I don't think so. I think you're exactly right.
It's kind of what he does. In this chapter, both Madeline and Robin need care from him in a way. So Madeline wants a proper talk. And Robin, while not necessarily asking for it, needs support from the shock of finding out that the happening's outside of her apartment. So Shrike is making a very clear choice and he chooses Robin. Remember in our last episode, Pools, where you wondered what Shrike's trying would be like with Robin?
I do.
I was thinking about this afterwards and it hit me that I think we're kind of already seeing it. Because look at her birthday. Look at him showing up when she moved and making practical plans in this chapter. I think he's already putting in that effort to make her happy. Mm-hmm. The talking part needs more work, but he's putting in more work in his relationship with Robin than literally anyone else.
It's so true. He's putting in the effort. He's not doing it with Madeline. He hasn't with any of his other girlfriends, but we see him doing it with Robin. I feel like once they finally start doing that talking thing, it's going to be like a dam breaking. We are going to drown in the emotions that we feel seeing him be exactly mm-hmm. what Robin wants and needs.
Oh my God.
I feel like this is just the start of the swooning and the emotions in this yeah. episode.
I feel like from now to the end of the book, from like two episodes ago to the end of the book, it's yeah. just emotion after emotion after emotion.
We're really going to have to keep upgrading that emotion closet.
It's an emotion walk-in now.
Exactly. So to start off this chapter, you'll remember that last episode, Strike and Robin visited the Epcots, and while Strike was inside simultaneously irritating the shit out of Inigo as well as interviewing him, Robin was outside taking a phone call, and here we get to see who called her and why, and it's not good news. The happening, knowing where Robin is living, is honestly the last thing that either one of them need right now.
I know I should feel really bad for Robin about this, but when I read it, I was so excited, and I still love that it forced them to find a place to stay.
Big same. Any excuse for a hotel stay, no matter how much trauma, I'm there.
It's not just that it's exciting in a shippy kind of way, but it gives me the sense of partnership. They're both not able to go back home for the same reason. It really feels like it's them against the world.
Aww, mm-hmm. Yeah.
These set of chapters with them traveling around like this is one of my favorite things about this book.
But before either one of them can worry about this too much, Gus emerges from the house, and after walking with them for a bit, he tells them that his father has been talking with a woman named Rachel.
Okay, here's my first takeaway from this conversation with Gus. When he comes out, he's nervous again that Strike and Robin are waiting for him and asks if they're wanting to talk to him. Maybe that should have been a little clue that they probably should have. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that they were just both, no,
we don't need a chance to talk to you, the son.
Why did they ask him anything?
Maybe it was because they still think he's been ruled out as a suspect, mm-hmm. but still, he could have had insights, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is this the first time and only time that Strike and Robin have actually talked directly to Gus?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Presumably, Joe did this deliberately so that Gus would fly under the radar as a suspect. But do you think he could have sustained a long interaction, like an interview with Robin and Strike, without giving himself away by giving off incel vibes that Robin could pick up on and be like, we need a second yeah. look at him?
That's a great question. Mm. I think it's possible that Gus would not have passed the smell test.
Yeah.
In more ways than one.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure that he'd be good at hiding his emotions in person. Mm-hmm. But also, part of me does want to believe that Robin is right, that you would be able to pick up on that kind of hatred within someone. You know, because I believe that's true.
Yeah, I believe it too. I feel like if she'd had an interview with him, Robin would have been like, oh shit, hang on.
Yeah, maybe that's why
yeah.
it didn't happen.
It's gotta be, yeah.
But the next thing that Gus says is, well, I'm going that way, explaining that he was walking with them to his car. Mm-hmm. And it immediately stands out to me as a mirror of the first time they interviewed the Epcots, and Flavia said the same thing when she was explaining why she was walking with them.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what it means, but it's there. And it took me right back to that moment when she's talking about the dogs and they're walking.
Maybe it's another thing meant to make us look away from Gus because it's aligning him with Flavia, who we like, who's a sweetheart, who's a child.
Maybe. I was thinking that it was a way to remind us about the dogs.
Oh, yeah. That could be it, too.
This thing Gus says about Rachel is interesting. Mm. Jumping ahead a little, we see in the chapter coming up with Rachel that she did reach out to Inigo's Billy Shears ME account on Twitter. But Gus is trying to suggest that this is an affair. Is he doing this to simply make Rachel look more suspicious, to cause problems for her? I don't quite understand why he does this.
I don't either, to be honest, because it doesn't seem like the smartest move on his part, since no. surely he knows that Rachel would be able to lead Strike and Robin directly to Morehouse, because he's seen her interact with Morehouse on Twitter.
Yeah.
I know he plans on killing Morehouse, but it still seems like a big risk, unless he never connected Rachel with Fiendy One.
I don't know.
Don't
He
know.
knows a lot of the mods. So we know he knows Morehouse, obviously, Hartella, Lord Draken Balbatora.
Yeah.
I don't know about Zoe.
Yeah.
But maybe he doesn't know that Fiendy One is Rachel and that he wants revenge for her rejecting him.
Oh, yeah. Because he does persecute her on Twitter. Okay. I could see that being a motive.
Yeah. I've always thought that maybe he did know everyone, but I don't really know if there's evidence to suggest that he knows Rachel or Zoe.
I don't think there is direct evidence.
But it also tells me that we are right in thinking that Gus is aware of his dad's Twitter persona if he knows that he and Rachel are talking.
Yeah. I imagine that it must feel very satisfying for Gus to insult his abusive father on Twitter.
I mean, he's about to do much worse. So
Yes.
Yeah.
Getting back to the call that Robin got from the police, we get a really sweet moment here when she rests her forehead on the steering wheel and Strike pats her shoulder comfortingly and then suggests that they stay overnight at a hotel in Whitstable. And here's where I swear I could feel people's hopes getting up that there would only be one bed.
My hopes were sky high.
Part of his reasoning for staying there is that no one knows they're there, which is practical. But he also tells her that she missed the meatiest part of the interview with Inigo and there'd be plenty to discuss. I just love it because he's saying that they'll have lots to talk about. It almost feels like he's saying, it'll be fun. We get to hang out and talk about the case.
Yeah.
And yeah, I said earlier that I should feel bad about this, but when Robin thinks about her new home and how it had been so briefly a haven, I do really feel bad for her because we know how excited she was to get that place.
And considering what happened after Career of Evil, where she and Matthew had to move because of the trauma she felt after having her home watched by Lang, this must be bringing back all kinds of difficult traumatic emotions for her, right? Being surveilled again in her home.
I'm sure. That's such a good point. I'm glad this didn't end up as badly as it did with Lang.
Yeah, me too.
On a lighter note, Robin's reaction to Strike telling her that Inigo thinks Anime is Yasmin is just solid gold.
I feel like we should really let Pools read this quote.
Yes, please. Robin's scorn really resonates with me here. Yasmin's not that good an actress, and nobody gullible enough to think they were having an online affair with a successful TV actor could have kept themselves hidden this long.
Did that feel cathartic?
It did. I felt cathartic all over the place.
Cathartic.
I don't think it's a real word, but it should be.
It sounds eerily similar to a word you hate.
I know. Don't ruin this for me. It's my special moment.
Her reaction to Nils and Yasmin making out is even better, though.
Her description of Nils not being a catch is hilarious. So she says, a stoner fascist who comes with a kid who might slit your throat in the night.
I love this bit so much. And yeah, choosing between Yasmin and Nils. I'd have to go with not getting my throat cut by the creepiest budding serial killer I've ever read about, but it was a tough choice for me.
I just love Robin being snarky like this, though. Remember in Silkworm when she scolded herself for thinking about how horrible Matthew's mother was?
Yeah. I love every time she gets a bit mean. She's human and she's annoyed by people, you know? She's not always nice and friendly. Sometimes people just fucking annoy her.
And Matthew's mother deserved it.
Matthew's mother deserved the hell out of that. She sounded like a piece of work.
There's another interesting bit here where Robin wonders out loud in front of Strike about whether or not she's a prude because she wouldn't be in an open relationship. And I'm wondering if you guys have any thoughts about that part.
I thought she could have also been talking about their commune living situation. But even if not, my answer to Robin would be absolutely not. Robin says that she couldn't live like that and doesn't get it. I don't get it either, especially when the person is Nils.
Yeah, the amount I get it is negative 20.
Yeah.
Strike doesn't answer because Robin just keeps talking. But I don't think that Strike would find that prudish at all.
No.
I mean, yes, he has problems with commitment, but I don't think that we've ever seen any evidence that he sees more than one woman at the same time. In fact, I think the opposite has been implied.
I totally agree. And I mean, we know that Strike is not a fan of communes or the lack of hygiene that seems to come with communes or the kind of personalities that are attracted to communes. And you're right that he seems to be a one woman at a time kind of guy. He mentions it when he thinks about telling Lorelai what he is and isn't able to commit to. And later with Madeline coming up in this section, he says that she's the only one he's been sleeping with. I think Strike would be in total agreement with Robin here. He has enough trouble just with one girlfriend.
Good Lord. Yeah.
What do you have time for? Two women
texting him?
Trying to think up the lies to cover himself for two women? Oh my God.
No.
Strike does not have the energy.
I do wish he would have answered Robin though, because they would have given, you know, her another check to put in that compatibility box.
It would have.
I love the way that Jo conveys Robin's shock here with her losing her train of thought and then the sudden bite-sized intrusive thoughts about the call and the pictures.
Yeah, because she's usually so sharp. It's incredibly unlike her to have her mind wander and to forget what she's saying. And you're right, it shows how affected she is by the happening, finding her home. And question, how did they find it so fast?
How did they, Ryan Murphy?
Looking at you, mister.
It seems that talking about the case does help her, though. Very much like Strike taking action.
Yeah, it does. I will say, though, by the end of this book, at least, I think that Robin probably needs therapy every bit as much as Strike does.
I don't have objections to Robin getting more therapy, but I don't see it happening the way I see it with Strike. Mm-hmm. If I had to guess, I'm betting that Strike would be the one to do this now.
I was always a bit disappointed that Robin didn't try to find a new therapist after Lethal White. I mean, I know she didn't seem to click with the one she had, and she was definitely not ready to talk about her feelings regarding Strike, but she's in a different place now, and maybe she would really benefit from a good therapist to talk things out with sometimes. But I guess she can't go to Prudence because it'd be a conflict of interest, which is too bad.
They can just go to coffee and talk.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a feeling Robin wouldn't have clicked with any therapist because she didn't want to talk about anything.
Yeah, no.
I just keep thinking that out of the two of them, Strike definitely needs it more.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We don't even know if Strike is going to go. We only know that someone makes the suggestion. Mm-hmm. So hoping for Robin to, it feels like too much somehow.
Yeah.
For me, I would put it on a wish list for maybe book 8. You know, if Strike goes to therapy and benefits from it, and I don't know, maybe talks to Robin about it. I just have this mental image of Strike saying something about it pissing him off a lot at first because of being like challenged on the things that you say and kind of think because they're ingrained into you and you know you don't really know any other way to think, but that after sticking with it that it's been helpful. I don't know, just considering that that's the exact complaint we see that she had before in Lethal White, and that was seemed to contribute to why she didn't want to continue. Maybe she could take some inspiration from that. You know, if Strike sticks with it, that maybe she could go back and maybe stick with it. And that could be helpful for her. Because like, it seems that on a fairly regular basis, at least every few months or so, she and Strike's lives are being threatened by something. And it would probably be a good idea to see a therapist regularly to make sure that you're not letting the stress of the job get to you too much.
I guess the reason why I just don't see it for Robin is because we know that she's already been at least twice in her life. And while she didn't open up about her feelings, the thing she really needed from therapy, she was successful at. She learned the tools and strategies to help her overcome her panic attacks. I think we all want to read her pouring her heart out about her feelings. But in terms of getting something out of therapy that really helped her change her life, she has done that. Mm-hmm. She was successful at therapy for why she went. We're starting to see her open up more with Ilsa. It's just not something that I would put on my predictions list because I do think that she did. It's just not the thing we wanted her to talk about.
No.
But she was successful.
One nights with Ilsa are a perfectly suitable replacement for therapy in my book. As long as she starts talking about her feelings with someone, I'm great with it being Ilsa and a bottle of wine.
Yeah. And like I said, what you just talked about dealing with the repeated trauma, she does have those tools that she learned from therapy. And I think she does use them.
Mm-hmm. She does. I'm just not sure that always talking about heavy stuff like that is necessarily something that she would always want to put on Ilsa, since it seems to happen like on a fairly regular basis.
I don't mean like the dangerous stuff with work. I just mean about her feelings for Strike. Mm-hmm. I think those are the things we wanted to see her talk about in Lethal White. But she didn't.
Yeah.
But she was successful at learning how to overcome her panic attacks. And so she still has those tools. So I don't really know if we need to see her go again if she has the tools and she's capable of doing it.
Wasn't there someone on Twitter once who said that the grumpiness generated from Strike going to therapy would be enough to solve the UK's energy crisis or something?
That does sound familiar. Yeah.
How does one convert grumpiness to electricity?
Oh, if they could do that, that would be amazing.
Grumpy windmill or you sigh.
Grumpy windmill. I'm still going for my I'm not sure about this, because if he's going to therapy, it's going to be he's volunteering to go.
Yeah, it's hard though. It's hard work.
I know.
It's unpleasant.
Irritating and exhausting.
I really like this part where they're talking about Inigo and Robin says that he is ill. Strike counters this by naming all of the many privileges Inigo has. And he says, I can think of plenty of people more deserving of pity than Inigo Upcott. I just think this is another interesting insight into how Strike feels about these things. What's another character that Strike had thoughts about that were so good like this? Was it Quine?
I think so. I definitely remember him having some choice thoughts about Quine's behavior.
Yeah.
Strike judging the shit out of horrible men is always an absolute delight.
It is, yeah, delightful. Very interesting that both Quine and Nego were both not great fathers. Am I remembering that correctly about Quine? I don't think he was abusive like Inigo, but he certainly didn't prioritize his family.
To me, his attitude towards Orlando, in my memory, was one of his few redeeming qualities. But I will say that he was a shit husband, and that's something he definitely has in common with Inigo.
Yeah, he treats her well. And I remember it saying in the show that he did a good bedtime story or something. I can't remember if that's in the book. But I just don't think him running off for days to be with girlfriends is just a crime against Leonora.
No.
With their family dynamic and situation, yeah. I feel like that hurts everyone. I don't think that's him being a good father, even if he treats her kindly when he's there.
That's fair.
Yeah, I would agree.
So yeah, I like Strike judging him too.
Yeah. I love when he says, "I'm not in the mood for slumming it. It's a business expense. Let's go somewhere decent."
Is it just me, or does he feel almost cheerful again?
He does, and we all know why that is. Come on.
Yeah. Oh my God, he's going to be so cute when they're finally together.
I can't think about stuff like this, or I might expire before we get the running grave. And I can't have that happen. I might die. You can't do that to me, Lindsay.
I'm sorry. It's just, he's going to be so cute.
I'm going to get you back. Don't worry.
Strike gets a text from Madeline and immediately blows it off. And it says, from the couple of visible sentences, it looked as though it might be lengthy. And the way that he nopes out of that by swiping it away is just way too relatable.
Yeah, and he's also way more interested in getting his fun night with Robin started.
Yeah.
And also probably making sure Robin's okay. Yeah. But obviously she's not his priority.
No, he has priorities, and we know which order they come in.
Melanated.
Speaking of, Madeline then resorts to calling him, and he takes the call outside, so Robin doesn't see him letting the call go to voicemail.
This annoyed me so much because I really wanted him to do exactly that. Let her see him ignore it.
Yes. Maybe he thinks that Robin would ask questions if he let it go to voicemail, which we all know isn't true because she's the most discreet person on the planet. Although, I really wish that Robin would sometimes ask questions that come into her head.
So do I. It was so nice in the beginning when they didn't know each other as well, but now it's just kind of annoying.
Yeah. Time to drop some of the discretion.
Definitely.
Time to become a nosy, you know.
Yeah, your best friend. You can ask a question.
Starts to become a nosy bunny. And I'm like, wait, that's not a thing. Why did...
Okay. Let's go with it. I like
Maybe
it.
Maybe because they wiggle their noses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense cute. To me. It is cute.
We can make it a thing.
It's now a thing. I'm going to be a nosy bunny. Aw, it's so cute. Okay. But anyway, it's lovely that we also get another moment of Strike here enjoying and being comforted by the sight and smell of the sea.
This has really become something I really love about him after this book. It's so endearing.
It really is. Maybe they can still take that trip to Greece and he can enjoy the Mediterranean.
There you go.
Or complain about how it's different from the English sea. It's too blue. It's too warm.
I would take him to the beach.
We know.
That sounds like a double entendre somehow. I'm going to take him to the beach.
I mean, I would take him to the beach.
That somehow sounded no less dirty when you said it the second time.
I'm going to go digging for clams in the sand. Searching for seashells. Waiting in. Getting a bit wet.
Oh, it's getting worse.
Way worse. Way worse. Let's just move on.
How do we go from it's so endearing to
I don't know. Seems like it's a journey that we take a lot.
Yeah, that's fair.
We made an abrupt swerve from like Swoon Town to Horn Town real quick.
They're connected. Can't help it.
So Madeline's novel length text that Strike reads, let's talk about it.
I like Strike. Felt an immediate urge to just swipe this off the page so that I didn't have to read it. She went full paragraph. Never go full paragraph.
That's how you lose your dignity.
Yeah, if only we could swipe Madeline off the page.
Yeah, bye.
First off, this text reminds me so much of what we read of the summary of Lorelai's letter to Strike in Lethal White. God, it was one of my favorite parts.
This was?
Yeah, I liked reading this part.
Oh my God, this is so cringe.
It is cringe.
I want to shake some dignity into these women. Like, oh my God.
I get that. I totally get that. I only like it because it was like, Oh, yeah, I feel like there might be some truth to it, even if he doesn't want to admit it.
Well, of course, but oh, it made me cringe for her.
Okay, brace yourself, Lindsay, while Kenz reads this.
That's payback for the room service thing, you know, where you guys didn't find it cringy and I was like about to die.
It's funny that you said have some dignity because I have this friend that I've known from the Harry Potter days. And when she first read Lethal White, she was furious with Lorelai. And I was like, really? You know, and she was like, I just want to tell her to have some self-respect. And I was like, oh, dang.
I'm pretty sure I've said the same thing.
I do get the argument, but I was like, all right. It was just very different than the normal reaction you get to Shrek and Lorelai. So interesting.
All right, I'm braced. I'm braced for the cringe.
All right, the secondhand embarrassment is incoming. Cormoran Strike was a fundamentally damaged and dysfunctional creature standing in the way of his own happiness. He caused pain to others due to the essential dishonesty of his emotional dealings. Never having experienced a healthy relationship, he ran from it when it was given to him. He took those who cared about him for granted and would probably only realize this when he hit rock bottom, alone, unloved, and tortured by regrets.
Obviously, the Lorelai email reminds me of this bit with Madeline.
Big time. So the biggest complaint in this text from Madeline is about Strike's lack of emotional honesty. And one of the things that she says here is, I'm sure you'll take the view that I'm being possessive and unreasonable, but for me, this is a matter of basic self-respect. I was warned this was what you're like. I didn't listen, and now I feel like I'm a bloody fool for ever going near you.
And she's talking about him spending the night at Robin's,
I
right?
think
Right
so.
here.
It's interesting that what she expects his view will be, you know, possessive and unreasonable, isn't what it actually is, because he knows he's in the wrong for lying. He knows that she's right to be mad at him for that, but he just doesn't feel bad enough about it to not do it. I don't think he thinks that Madeline is being unreasonable and being angry about this. He just doesn't want to deal with it. And also, Madeline, if we're talking about basic self-respect, I have some tips, and it doesn't involve writing this text.
Anything that involves writing novel-length texts
No.
or emails to
No.
men whose relationships you're not going well with.
Never gonna have the result that you want. They're never gonna read it and be like, oh my God, she's so right and
I
insightful.
will
I need to
change.
change for her. It's not gonna happen, my girl. He already knows. He just doesn't give a shit, as illustrated beautifully by Strike in this chapter.
So when she says, I was warned this is what you're like, are you guys thinking this is probably all just Charlotte, right?
I think it's just Charlotte. And I think that it says that later on too, that it was Charlotte. The thing that I'm kind of wondering is how emotionally dishonest was he with Charlotte? Because I've always thought that his relationship with Charlotte was closer than it was with the other women. But I wonder if Charlotte is aware of how he is with other women and told her.
That's an interesting question. I've always thought that it was Strike's relationship with Charlotte that contributed to him being so closed off with women because, you know, and lying and protecting himself, it's instinctive to keep as much as you can secret, to not give things to the other person that can be used to hurt you, like Charlotte did with it. I've always imagined he was much more open with Charlotte, at least in the first years of their relationship, because in Troubled Blood, he called it the longest and closest relationship of his life. That being said, I think that what Charlotte has been telling Madeline is lies about Strike, that he's a cheater, that he's secretive, that he runs around on women, that he's sleeping with Robin. It's not the actual reality of Strike's issues with emotional commitment. She's
That makes
just
sense.
shit-stirring.
I've always thought that a lot of that also came from Leda, and Charlotte just made it worse. But I think you're totally right that Charlotte was filling her head with lies. You know what gives me a lot of happiness, though? Charlotte has probably been plotting this whole time that she's getting her way back into Strike's life with the divorce. He's going to help her, and they'll get back together, and messing with Madeline is a fun game, and they'll laugh later about how she got Madeline out of the way. And it all just leads up to this total slap in the face where he leaves her standing in the street knowing he doesn't want her. That's pretty satisfying, right?
Yes, talk about catharting all over the place. That's me. That is peak catharsis. Oh, I can't wait.
I'm cathartic all over the place. Sounds so
Catharting
disgusting.
everywhere. I know. So
disgusting.
It's my new thing.
So messy. It's
It's
like very
cringe
messy.
in my ears.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's super satisfying. And we get to read about their connection breaking next episode.
That's next episode?
Hell yeah,
Oh
it is.
shit. That's exciting. I'm
It
gonna go
is.
do my notes right away.
Yeah, we got a little off topic there, but going back to the messages from Lorelai and Madeline, I don't actually think that either of them are necessarily wrong. With Madeline's jealousy about Robin, it's the same argument I'll give about Matthew. They're wrong that something is actually physically happening between Shrike and Robin, but they're not wrong about the deeper aspects of their jealousy.
Yeah, she is definitely not wrong about his feelings towards Robin.
Yeah.
Although Madeline seems much more focused later on Charlotte and being jealous of Charlotte and on Strike wanting to sleep with famous or rich women or whatever, right? Because those were the big things that she accused him of during those two drunk fights, which seems to me like they weighed more on her mind than Robin did.
I wonder if Charlotte started implying that
Oh, I think Charlotte
they were
definitely
getting
does.
back together.
Yeah.
There's something going on.
I think Charlotte definitely did.
But Lorelai, I think she's right in what she wrote. I just don't think it was the right approach if she wanted or expected them to stay together.
Yeah, I mean, there was no approach she could take to make that
No.
happen, let's be real. But this last line of Lorelai's summarized email, it's basically describing the end of Ink Black Heart. Like you said, strike at rock bottom, tortured by regrets. That's, Lorelai is a prophet.
I'm really glad you picked up on this because I have always wondered if Lorelai's email was a bit of foreshadowing of something to come. And if you're right, there it is, right there. I hope. It's really another thing that's making me go back to the idea about why I think these parallels exist between Madeline and Lorelai to show that repeat pattern of behavior, but exaggerating everything with Madeline and breaking him down. The more I think about this, the more hope I get that we have reached the end of Strike's bad dating life because I feel like this was done on purpose. There are too many similarities between Madeline and Lorelai, and I don't think it was to stretch anything out or change an order. I just think it was to bring Lorelai's prediction to reality and cause some change in him.
I'm putting a lot of stock in that watershed moment comment that Joe made on Twitter.
Yeah, me too.
I don't think he's going to backslide much in the running grave.
We'll see in 79 days.
Strike books the two of them rooms at the Marine Hotel, which you can find pictures of on Strike Fans, and they're really great pictures. I'll put a link in the show notes.
The way this chapter ends, Robin is blank faced, still upset, and I just love the way Strike acts with her by taking care of her in this very practical way. It reminds me of the way he takes care of her when he helps her move by bringing food and support.
It is really sweet. I know that Robin's blank face is probably just still because of the happening, but we also know perfectly well that it's possible she's blank faced thinking about Strike out there talking to Madeline, right?
She certainly hates thinking about Madeline, so it's probably not helping. I remember when I first read this that I kind of laughed that he mentions buying toothpaste and socks because I know they're going to need so much more than that. And my first thought was underwear. That is immediately where my anxious mind went because I had this whole scenario in my head about how awkward it would be going to the store and having to buy underwear in front of each other. It's a weird thing to think about, but it stresses me out if I were Robin.
Okay, I could see them feeling a bit of awkwardness, yeah, about buying underwear in front of each other. I personally wouldn't really be super stressed about it, but I can totally see where you're coming from.
Your nerves or awkwardness meter must be made of steel.
I think different things make each of us anxious. Like, I think we have different,
Yeah, because all I
because,
could think of is he's going to know what kind of underwear I'm wearing tomorrow. Like if I were Robin, he's going to know what style I chose, the color. He's going to think about it.
Whereas I'm thinking, oh, Strike is going to be having fantasies about her in her underwear. Maybe he'll knock on the room
I
between
mean,
them, you
if you were
know?
Robin,
Yeah, I guess.
as me, I want him to think about her underwear. As a Robin, I'd be horrified.
Yeah, now I'm just thinking about Strike, thinking about Robin's underwear, and we're going nowhere because I'm
Is straight to
often,
Horntown.
yeah, we didn't stop off at Swoon Zone. We took the express.
All right.
God.
Let's go to chapter 79 before we just
Let's.
unravel completely.
So in chapter 79, Strike breaks up with Madeline.
Woohoo!
Hallelujah.
Fucking finally.
So the epigraph for chapter 79. Love never comes but at love's call, and pity asks for him in vain. Because I cannot give you all, you give me nothing back again. And that is from an insincere wish addressed to a beggar by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge.
When I was doing these notes, I briefly read beggar as badger, and I want to read that poem.
An insincere wish addressed to a badger. That sounds both
Yes.
amazing and hilarious, and I need it to
Yeah, I
exist.
was really disappointed when I realized it wasn't speaking to a badger.
Yeah, no kidding.
I think you should write one just for
Oh,
fun.
I'm tempted. I don't write good poetry, though. I'm not a good poet.
Okay. Do you think this is Madeline's voice here? I can't give you everything when you give me nothing back. Because it's a bit more sympathetic than I'm willing to be for her. I get that part of it is painful that she went into it hoping for something that he can't give, but her behavior ruins the sympathy.
I think that this epigraph is definitely sort of from her perspective. The rest of the poem makes it clear to me. We've got these lines, and these are from the poem. For wealth has lifted me above, and falsehood set you down below. And you can't forget that I am rich, nor I that you are telling lies. So for me, that sort of that money fame thing has been a huge issue for Madeline. And even though she doesn't bring it up here, you know, and even though it has zero basis in reality, we know it's shaping her thinking. And the lines about the lies are pretty telling too, considering what this particular argument is about.
Yeah.
But I think that the use of this poem emphasizes that Madeline really doesn't understand where their fundamental incompatibility really lies and just how insurmountable it is as an issue.
Yeah.
All right. So Strike and Robin arrive at the Marine Hotel, and we learn that they secured the last two rooms for the night, smashing the hopes and dreams of many a shipper into half a bajillion pieces.
Yep.
I do remember getting to this part and thinking, she's not going to have there be only one room. Surely that's not going to happen.
I was wishing. But the fact that they got the last two rooms, they were so close. It's really just rubbing salt in the wound for me. Joe did this on purpose just to torment me personally. I am very certain of it. Mm-hmm. Yes, me personally. Because when you're talking about hopes and dreams dashed, it was rough. It was a hard couple minutes reading this section. Especially when we get to the fact that there are two beds in Robin's room.
I know.
Come on. I wanted her to listen to him breaking up with Madeline.
Strike's indignation about there not being a lift and not getting help carrying their non-existent luggage is priceless.
Maybe it's a sign that he's appreciating a functioning elevator and that maybe he needs to get his fixed. Or maybe he can only complain about it when it's not his.
There you go. 3 books ago, they were staying in hotel rooms that were 5 rooms away from each other, and now they're just a wall away.
A combined room. I wonder if it's one that has a door in between, like a lot of hotels do.
Ooh.
If it doesn't, it should.
When Strike is complaining about the non-existent service, there's a mention of the Ritz here. And I'll admit that the first time that I read this, my breath kind of caught in my chest for a moment. And I really wondered whether or not this was going to be something they were actually going to end up talking about in this book. Did that happen for any of you guys?
I don't remember what I thought. Obviously, Robin wasn't making a point to talk about it, but it was so exciting to see that taboo start to break a little and that she mentioned it. I too was very excited.
Robin is so thoughtful here when she offers Strike the room with the sea view. I just love the little aside from her about Strike having that Cornish thing going on.
Yeah, tell us what else he has going on, Robin, please. And very much like to hear her thoughts on that. But yeah, it is very sweet. It's the little things you do for the people you love.
I was just amazed that she managed to keep her orientation walking up flights of stairs through this building enough to know which room had the sea view. Maybe I just have the worst sense of direction on the planet, but I don't think I could have gotten to these two doors and been like, oh, that one has a sea view. I'd be like, where the fuck am I?
You just bounce into a door frame and turn around and you don't know which way you're going.
Yes, that's my life. That's my life.
You're like pinball, but with door frames.
Yep.
I didn't think about that, but maybe it's obvious when you're there.
Or maybe Robin's just a genius.
That's also possible.
Spatial genius.
Speaking of the whole sea view thing, it says that Strike was touched, but too out of breath and worried about his leg to become effusive.
For some reason, this moment makes me so curious about how they'll interact when they're in a relationship. How will he respond when she does something he finds touching? How will she?
Okay, you can't just make me wonder things like that. I don't have the emotional strength to
try. That's what emotion closets are for.
I know, but
does this mean I'm winning the swoon wars right now?
Yeah.
So speaking of the idea about sharing a room that came up earlier, it actually comes up in an internal monologue that has, in my opinion, one of the funniest lines from the book, where Robin imagined their accountant, who was a singularly humorless man, asking why they couldn't have cut costs by sharing. Barclay's comment after his sole encounter with the man had been, "Looks like he shits staples."
Yeah, I agree. That was hilarious.
It's amazing.
Do either of you think that this might be a little nod from Jo to readers that she knows this was a thing that people wanted? I'm sure she knows of tropes people like, or just romance tropes in general.
Absolutely. The fact that it's a humorless accountant asking because of costs rather than a hopeless romantic asking because of bed sharing, I think that's definitely, yeah, it's her little joke. Also, talk of another instance of bias against accountants here to our one accountant listener.
I can't believe I missed that one.
Yeah.
Stay away from staplers, please.
Next, Robin receives a couple of texts. There's one from her mother, Linda, and another one on her burner phone from Pez.
How cool is Robin that she has a burner phone?
Right?
Very cool.
The first one from Linda is her requesting an update after the bomb.
I have to say, and I'm not trying to criticize Robin because I think she's right in giving the response that she did, but she certainly is lying by omission a bit. You know, she says she's perfectly okay and the police are making progress. Are they though? And totally fails to mention the neo-Nazi taking pictures of her apartment or the fact that she can't go home. It made me laugh because Strike isn't the only one lying to the people in his life.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anything she's saying is technically false.
The police making progress is a bit iffy.
They're making progress in that they took a picture of a neo-Nazi who found her home. That's progress of a sort. They're tailing a Nazi. Yeah, but I think mentioning that whole thing would, you know, you're right. It would just make Linda worry more. It wouldn't solve anything.
Yeah, and that's why I say I think her response is probably right.
Yeah.
But I just see similarities with how Strike is with Lucy when he doesn't want her to worry or be overbearing.
Mm-hmm. Remembering in Cuckoo's Kong, he's like, yeah, business has doubled lately.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's not technically wrong.
The exact same kind of technically correct that Robin is doing here. She's really learned from the master.
It's so funny. No, it's not a criticism. I really enjoy this. I think it's funny.
Yeah, it is.
So next we have Pez, who decides to send her a picture of a drawing of his imaginings of what Jessica Robbins looks like naked. Her first reaction to seeing that he sent her a picture is understandable after Morris, but it still kind of makes me laugh where she's like, please don't be a dick pic.
Yeah, I can't decide which I think is worse. The drawing almost feels more intrusive to me because it's of her. You know, if someone sent me a dick pic, I'd roll my eyes, think they're gross, but this feels like more of a violation.
This is a really gross of him. I agree.
This is another thing I didn't like about Pez. If he had drawn a picture of her that wasn't naked, which he could have done, that could be sweet.
Yeah.
But his immediate go-to is to be sexual with a woman who's already turned him down.
Yeah. It's like, just push harder.
Robin then logs into the game and we see the result of Strike's work impersonating Buffy Paws in the game when Fiendy immediately sends her a private channel message about football. And I have to say, the thought of Strike nerding out about football with Fiendy is so wholesome and adorable, and I just love it.
It's precious.
I actually went to YouTube and typed in Ferdinand Header and the video I'm assuming they're talking about comes right up.
I did not do that.
It wasn't super exciting.
It's like a dude hitting a football with his head, I assume.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. You know what, though? I would totally like to see a scene with Strike watching a game and being totally enthralled, you know, yelling and everything, how they do. It would be fun.
He did that in Silkworm. He had a football game on while he was
reading.
He was like, oh, if I hadn't been reading this, I would have won. I'm like, yeah, it's typical guy stuff right there.
If I hadn't been reading about a diseased penis.
God, they would have won.
I really love that Robin's initially confused and she thinks football. It's literally in italics. You can tell exactly how she thought the word. It's just, ugh.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That moment is hashtag relatable because it would take me a minute to be like, oh, football.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Open up Google.
It says that she had half a mind to bang on the wall and ask him about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm laughing at the idea that she could have done that while he was having his conversation with Madeline, because that could have been funny.
Oh my God. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Madeline saying, do you even want this? And it's just knock, knock, Strike.
He's like, sorry, I got to take this.
Oh, that's so good.
Amazing.
It's urgent. It's work related.
Come over to my hotel room, please. I have a question for you.
While his stump jumped around as though electric pulses were running through it, he thought he should have seen from the first that his and Madeline's lives were fundamentally incompatible. She needed a man happy to stand beside her and beam while the camera flashes exploded. She deserved someone who cared about her enough to look past a scene born of stress and too much alcohol, and he qualified on neither count.
Yeah, I remember thinking a little ouch when it comes to him not caring enough to look past her behavior.
Yeah.
Not that he should look past it. It's just the wording was a little,
yeah,
ooh.
The wording is like, yeah, it hurts.
Yeah. Also, we know that the fundamental incompatibility is a bit of an appeal to him.
It definitely is. He's drawn to these relationships he knows aren't going to work long term, mm-hmm. while the woman who is fundamentally compatible with him in every single way is standing right there. Open your eyes, strike.
I'm not going to sing You Belong With Me right now. I'm not going to do it.
Just saying the title gets it stuck in my head.
Sorry. Anyway, he also thinks that he was prepared to offer an apology for lying, but he knew that if he didn't end it now, it would only increase the mutual resentment that was growing. Mm-hmm. We've talked before about how it seems like he has trouble ending relationships. Mm-hmm. And while this one lasted longer than it should have, he does realize here and now that he needs to end it. And he does. So maybe we could give him a little credit for this one.
Yeah, I'll give him some credit here. Okay. I was super impressed that he called her right away once he was alone and got it over and done with, because I'd have procrastinated the hell out of that phone call. So maybe I empathize with him in this pattern of, you know, letting it go on more than I thought, because yeah, I'd be putting that off.
I feel like we need a sound effect when it turns into Therapy Edition.
Oh yeah.
It's like, oh, that's me. Gong.
The little chun gong.
Of course, later it does say that he stays silent for a second, hoping that she would be the one to end it.
Oh my God.
But yeah. He still does it.
Yeah, he does.
He gets half a point. I also noticed that part of his thoughts here are that she deserved someone who was willing to stand next to her and care enough. He's not thinking completely negatively about her here, but I don't think that's going to last after what happens later.
I mean, we know he likes and admires things about her. He cares a little, just not enough. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know how long that caring is going to extend after she physically assaults him.
It's over.
Yeah.
And then comes this moment that we've all been waiting for. Strike calling Madeline back to have a proper talk.
Finally, been waiting for it since chapter 3.
So while he's on the phone with Madeline, Strike apologizes for lying and admits that he stayed at Robin's place the previous night.
I like that right before he admits this, he turns his head toward the window and towards the sea, like he's taking some sort of comfort or encouragement from it.
Yes, and he was hoping that he'd be able to have this conversation on the balcony overlooking the sea, right? I feel like there's some kind of symbolism there of looking at something so vast, mysterious, and powerful for comfort, because it reminds you that in the end, you are a very small part of the universe. This moment is just a moment that's going to pass. Puts everything in perspective. But also there's that sort of water symbolizing rebirth, renewal, a washing clean of annoying, clingy girlfriends. And then there's also being near Joan to draw strength from her. I mean, take your pick about the symbolism with the ocean and him.
Maybe he was just wanting to jump out the window.
I like that one too.
He needed to escape.
Fuck, I need
I'm out of here.
Oh, that's funny.
I think I found another Lethal White parallel here, because even though it's clear this is over, Madeline, like Lorelai, asks if he still wants this and wants to be with her. So Madeline says, "Do you want this, Corm?" she demanded, her voice higher than usual, choking back tears. "Do you actually want to be with me?" And it says that Lorelai's email requested a further meeting so that they could decide whether you want this relationship enough to try a different way.
There's the cringe hitting, like, oh, baby girls.
I don't know if I'm being too hard on them, but it's odd to me that both women don't acknowledge the clear incompatibility and think that they can change him.
I just keep thinking he must be really, really good in bed for both of these women to be throwing their dignity out the window trying to
I bet
him.
You're thinking about that.
I'm usually thinking about
it's got to be something, because I just don't get why either of them want to be with someone who so clearly does not want to be with them.
I don't get it either.
It's the moment of truth. We finally get to this moment when Strike finally ends things with her. He expected her to argue, perhaps to shout at him, because the scene at her launch had revealed a perfect willingness to wound when hurt. Instead, after a couple more sobs, she hung up.
I knew when I first read this that this wasn't the end, or it wasn't the last of her, I should say, because that willingness to wound was bound to turn up later.
Quite literally.
Yeah, wound to the thigh.
Yeah.
That's a high kick.
She's impressive. She's probably reasonably tall. I don't know.
if they do that scene in Ink Black Heart of just like, that's a really high, you gotta get someone who can kick high.
She can't even be wearing a very tight skirt. Like, what?
No.
Wow.
Or she just doesn't care. I mean, he's seen it already.
Oh my God. We're gonna have to dissect this further when we get to the actual scene. Let's put a pin in that. I'm trying to think of all the fights that Robin has had with Strike and with Matthew. Has she ever shown this kind of willingness to wound them when she's hurt? Because as
No.
far as I can remember, she's been pretty angry with both of them. But everything she said during fights has been honest. It's been about speaking her truth rather than attacking them, right?
Right. No, I can't think of anything either. And it's not like she wouldn't have had plenty to work with when it came to Matthew.
Right? She took it easy on Matthew.
Yeah. The fight between Strike and Robin in the car that's coming up, if she had wanted to hurt him, there are quite a few things she could have said that would have really hurt him.
Yes.
But that's not her. That's not what her intention
No.
was. It doesn't even occur to her to do that.
She wouldn't do it. It's not who she is.
Yeah.
I think Strike is going to be surprised again once they're together at how different every aspect of being with Robin is. I know we talk about how much we want to see them being cute and the flirting and, all that stuff, but I also can't wait to see their first fight as a couple because it's going to be such a revelation and a departure for him.
If only just to see his complete joy when she doesn't act like Charlotte
I know,
and they get
which
to make up. It'll be
she
so
doesn't
sweet.
throw things or kick
Yeah.
him.
Or hurt him.
100% less throwing of random shit in your direction.
Let's go to chapter 80.
All right, in chapter 80, Robin convinces Rachel Ledwell to speak with her.
The epigraph, I know not what can ease my pains, nor what it is I wish. The passion at my heartstrings strains like a tiger in a leash. And that's Oh, Is It Love by Amy Levy. If this is about Strike and Robin, which I think it is, I'm going to melt into a puddle like Alex Mack, and please, one of you, tell me you know who Alex Mack is.
Of course I do. I
Oh, thank
love
God.
that show. It was classic.
Yeah,
Absolutely
it was.
classic.
Strike is so close to acknowledging his feelings for Robin in this chapter. It's so close. And it fits perfectly with this passage. So the first two lines, I know not what can ease my pains, nor what it is I wish. That's his confusion slash denial he's still in about what he feels for her. And the last two lines, the passion at my heartstrings strains like a tiger in a leash. That's literally the love in his heart straining and pulling and trying to be let free from Strike holding back that leash. You know? Oh, it's so good. Even the title, Oh, Is It Love? Yes. Yes, it is, you doofus.
Yeah, I
Yes.
agree completely on all counts. It's love, and this poem is so totally about their feelings for each other.
Yeah.
And
Oh.
like you said, particularly Strike, because he's the one who's not given it a name yet.
Yeah, this is such a good chapter.
It is. We open this next chapter with Robin knocking on the door to check on him because apparently Strike passed out after his conversation with Madeline, and I can't say I blame him really. I mean, the physical and emotional exhaustion had to have been a lot for him, poor guy.
He's probably relieved too, able to sleep well.
Right,
Yeah.
finally. There's another funny moment here when Robin asks after Strike's leg, and he responds that it, quote, keeps moving of its own accord. And Robin's first response is to look at his prosthesis. It was amazing.
Yeah, this has to be one of the funniest moments in the book.
The image of his prosthetic being haunted, hopping around on its own, is so good.
Does that remind me of?
Babbity Rabbit or something of,
Yes,
yes.
because the
Yeah.
boot is hopping. That
The
is
boot
exactly
hops.
it.
Yep. Oh my
Thank
God.
you.
Sometimes we're just so in
I
sync, you know.
know. I know I'm getting too sentimental here, but remember in Cuckoo's Calling when Strike was so worried about developing any kind of intimacy or closeness with Robin? I bet he never would have imagined that she's the person he would let into his hotel room with his leg off, talking about his pain.
God, that's gross.
Like I was saying earlier, I feel like we're going to need an upgrade from the emotions closet to something a bit larger. I'm thinking like at minimum, like a 2,000 square foot emotion closet that I can just scream into, swoon into.
Closet can no longer contain the emotions.
No.
Back to Strike's leg. Robin asks if he wants to go see a doctor, and Strike responds with, "There's no point." I suppose in some ways he's right, even though I kind of rolled my eyes when he said it, because it's really not something a doctor can magically fix. He's got to be the one to do it.
Yeah, he knows what he needs to do to help. Is like, he thought of a whole list of things in the shower when it first started doing this that would probably help it. So doctor's just going to tell him what he already knows.
Yeah.
But I wonder, now that they're doing so much better financially, do you think Strike will ever invest in a better prosthetic leg? Because he mentions in Troubled Blood when he's talking to Dr. Gupta that his model is basic NHS, right? Yeah. But you've got to be able to buy a better model privately, and you'd think that since his job requires a whole lot of walking, that would be a really important investment.
Yeah, I think so.
You can claim it as a business expense.
Exactly.
He could possibly need a new one when he loses weight, so I think that's really something to consider, that mm-hmm. could actually happen.
I think so.
It might come with, you know, if he's starting to be more honest about things he needs to do to take care of himself, that seems like something that could come up.
Getting a new leg, fixing the lift,
telling Robin he loves her.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put that at the top of the list.
Yeah. Let's move that one right up.
We'll move the lift number down one. A bit.
Yeah.
After this, they make plans to meet downstairs to discuss more of the case.
Was I the only one who was annoyed at Strike when he turned down Robin's offer to help him get downstairs? And not just because he's being stubborn, but come on, dude, that's your arm around her. It's being close to Robin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Help me out, Strike, with my shippy needs.
Right.
What are you doing?
We could have had another moment of Robin enjoying the feel of him being all bulky and warm next
yes,
to her.
Yes, I want to read about that.
Yes, God.
I'm going to need another swoon closet.
I very much want to read about him being bulky and warm.
Next to her in other ways?
In all the ways.
All right, once Robin's seated, there's another sweet bit where she orders herself a glass of wine and chooses a seat facing the sea, which she thinks is only fair because she gave Strike the sea view room.
It is only fair. And you know what? I think Strike likes his view just fine, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that given his choice, Strike would definitely choose the Robin view chair.
Mm-hmm. Especially when she's wearing blue.
That's practically the ocean, but better.
Robin then logs into the game and notices that Anime is still absent, which is significant because Ormond is still in custody.
So that's a red herring, but we know that we just left Gus heading out to do something. Mm-hmm. AKA kill Morehouse, so he couldn't have been logged in. I wonder why he didn't have Hartella log in for him this time.
Maybe he's planning on having her log in around the time of the murder, give him an alibi, so like the day leading up to it isn't as important.
Yeah, that seems like a stupid thing to do, because she could just give the police all the times that she logged in.
Yeah.
And as I'm saying this, I'm remembering that Strike asks her if she kept a log, and of course she didn't. So never mind. Never mind.
Hartella's genius strikes again.
Doesn't she know that you can always potentially be a witness to murder? Right? Am I the only one who checks the time if I hear a weird noise or see something suspicious? Because if the police need to know when I saw it, I want to get it right.
Exactly. It's not just you. I do it too.
Oh, good.
Although I immediately forget the time 5 minutes after.
I know, me too. But my intentions are there.
Yeah, the intention's there.
Pez continues to pester her via text, despite her saying that she's busy spending time with her parents.
On my first read, I remember thinking that Strike was going to somehow see the text from Pez and see the drawing of Robin naked and be so jealous/interested in the drawing, if you know what I mean.
Interested.
Burgeoning interested, you might say.
I thought that there was nothing I wanted more than for Strike to see the drawing that Robin did of Pez, but I was wrong. This is what I wanted to see.
Yeah, I really wanted it.
We're so close to so many good things in this chapter.
It would have been so deliciously awkward, especially if Robin knew that he saw it.
Robin's thoughts then start to wander to Matthew and what his reaction would have been if this had happened while they were still married.
We've talked about this, but the feeling of freedom for her is really highlighted in this book. There was some of it in Troubled Blood, but she was still dealing with him, so she wasn't as emotionally free.
I didn't realize it until you said this, but she barely thinks of Matthew at all in this book, because I just looked it up and his name only appears 17 times, and most of those are either in the prologue or when she's thinking about him in reference to how much she loves Strike. Bloody Matthew was such a weight pressing down on Robin and us. And I didn't realize how pleasant it was not having him around being an asshole until just now.
It is quite pleasant.
Yeah. It's so nice.
It's funny because Strike is always wanting his space and his freedom too. Mm-hmm. But it really seems like they're both the most free when they're together. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a bit of the Mazenkov and Krupov thing. where teaming up allows them to be more free and carrying less of a burden.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but I really liked it in this book.
These text bits I'm about to read when Robin's thoughts move to Madeline and Strike's room service lie reads as a bit of foreshadowing. And there's another similar line to this in another book. And she says, she suspected that one of the things he'd wanted to do upstairs was soothe his girlfriend's feelings. She wondered what Strike sounded like when he was trying to sweet talk somebody. She'd never heard him do it. Little does she know.
Yeah, it's the opposite of sweet talk.
Yeah.
And yes, I believe this is the second time Robin has wondered about how Strike sounds when speaking to a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. She also does this in Career of Evil in chapter 8, and she thinks that it was difficult to imagine Strike murmuring endearments to anyone. Mm. It just makes me wonder if we'll get a moment of payoff from these two instances where Robin is pleasantly surprised by his murmured endearments.
Oh my God. Okay, what really gets me here is that we've never heard him doing any sweet talking either. We've never heard him say any endearments, because most of the scenes with his girlfriends that we've witnessed are, you know, fights or him trying to escape or him making minimal conversation while actually thinking about work or Robin or about work and Robin. So I think that we are going to be just as pleasantly surprised as Robin is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think I need to take a break to go swoon for a bit.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Right.
We think we have a book crush now.
It's going to be out of control.
We're going to be
need to be locked up.
Strike arrives at the restaurant, and I love that he thinks that he might compliment her on how the color of her shirt suited her.
Oh my God. Okay. Oh. Have I ever been more upset with Robin in my life than I was in this moment where she asks how his leg is and stops him from complimenting her?
Oh.
Robin, work with me.
Furious. It's like, for once in your life, can you be just a little less considerate, Robin?
I know. Jo knows exactly how much she's killing all of us here, because we've just had Robin wondering how Strike sounds when he's sweet talking. And not that a compliment necessarily means sweet talking, but you know that Robin would have felt giddy about
it. Oh my God, she would have exploded.
I know. It was the perfect setup for a compliment, and it was just taken away. It kills me. This is the chapter of so close.
I don't think I can take another book of being tortured like this. I think it might genuinely kill me.
It always makes me laugh when she liked my tweet to her that said, "You're enjoying this, aren't you?"
Yeah.
When talking about her torturing us.
She super is. Very sadistic, Joe. Very sadistic.
Going back to the case, though, I love that Strike's innocent chatting about football with Feeny One is what leads to such a breakthrough. This might not make sense, but it makes sense to me that Robin, having zero interest in this, would be the one to see the connection between the team Feeny likes being called Peacocks and the Twitter handle Penny Peacock. I just feel like if it's common knowledge to you, it might go totally unregistered. I don't know. That might be nonsense.
No, I get it. It's like earlier with the Pete Best reference. Robin catches something that Strike wouldn't have, because she's coming at things from a different standpoint of not knowing something. Her perspective gives revelations about things that Strike just glosses over because they're normalized, their background noise to him instead of an unknown.
Yeah.
Robin shares her last conversation with Feeny in the game, who announces that she's leaving, as well as a series of tweets that help connect the dots about Rachel Ledwell's identity as Feeny online.
Can I just say that I find it absolutely adorable and endearing that Feeny says that talking to Strike, aka Buffy Paws, had been the most fun she's had in the game in ages.
Maybe there is something to be said about the value of anonymity on the internet as a sort of leveler, because both Feeny and Strike had a really positive interaction about a shared interest, one that never would have happened outside of this anonymous space, because 16-year-old girl and 40-year-old man who isn't a creep and doesn't particularly want to look like a creep.
Yeah, I mean, the internet does allow the opportunity to branch out and make friendships you wouldn't normally make or be able to make.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a nice moment. I liked that.
Me too.
I also feel really bad for Rachel that she's so anxious because of Anime.
Yeah, I can kind of relate to her here. Being so hurt and stressed about internet things, because when you get wrapped up in an online community, it becomes a real significant part of your life, and shit going down in your online life feels just as stressful as shit going down in your real life. I mean, yes, it's particularly bad for Rachel here because an actual murderer might track her down, but I relate.
It also just makes it extra painful because had Morehouse been able to forgive her and not let Paperwhite drive that wedge between them, they could have been the pair teaming up to stop Anemy. And I believe that they could have done it, which I know is exactly why Gus caused so much trouble between them. But it sucks to see it here that they were both so clearly on the same page.
It really, really does suck. I feel like this novel has so many what ifs that are just painful to think about in the case and in their personal lives more than any of the others, I think. Although that might just be bias from being currently immersed in this one. But right. I feel like the song of this novel is, you know, we could have had it all.
Rolling in the deep.
Rolling in the... Rolling. You've connected the dots.
And then we finally get to see the origin of Rachel's Fiendy username, as well as seeing what her and Morehouse's friendship used to be like.
I don't think that I had understood or made the connection with her username Fiendy, that it's from an argument where her dad, Grant Ludwell, called her a fiend from hell. I think this is the first time I'm realizing that. And what an awful thing to say to your child.
It's horrible. If Grant Ledwell hadn't already been on my shit list, this would have gotten him on it.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if I think that it's a good thing or a bad thing that she took that and made it her identity in the game. I don't know.
I think it just shows that that comment must have really stuck with her for her to come back to it in this way. I can definitely understand the desire to take something hurtful and make it your own as a way to try to lessen the hurt.
Yeah.
That's probably where this choice of username comes from.
Regarding Morehouse and Rachel's conversation on Twitter, though, the timestamp is October 16th, 2012, and they're talking about Alpha Centauri B. And if you remember or Googled it like I just did, on October 16th, 2012, here's a quote from the New York Times. A team of European astronomers had found a planet the same mass as Earth's in Alpha Centauri, a triple star system that is the sun's closest neighbor, only 4.4 light years away. So I think that's what Morehouse meant by I wouldn't pack your bags just yet, as though moving to a different Earth-sized planet. And it also says that he's skeptical that it's even real.
Yeah, he is. Since you've researched it, don't keep me in suspense. Did it turn out to be real or do we not know?
On Wikipedia, it says that 3 years after the discovery in 2015, that Oxford published a paper entitled Ghost in the Time Series, demonstrating the flaws in the original analysis. The Oxford team found the signal was caused not by a planet, but instead it was a mathematical artifact of the window function used to create the time series for the original observations. I don't know half of the words I just read to you, but I think it means that Morehouse was right, that this so-called new planet didn't exist.
It just makes me kind of sad because if Vikas had lived, he could have been publishing that paper. And at the very least, he would have been someone who would have been really interested.
Yeah.
Robin has Strike read a bunch of pages of tweets from her research while she's DMing back and forth with Rachel. And this series of tweets about Edie being homeless in the past really kind of pisses me off, especially Yasmin's tweet, just because she used to work with her. It just really irritates me greatly. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of mind-boggling to think of how many of these accounts are all just Gus.
Do we know how many are Gus? So there's the Lapine's Disciple, the M. Rieger, the Evola, and Jay Baldwin. Those are all Gus.
Gus is literally just sitting here talking to himself on Twitter all day.
Yeah.
It makes him seem even more pathetic than I thought.
The only other one is, well, there's Hortella, and then there's Mooney Spoons, which do you think that could be Kia with an alternate account?
Oh, well, now I think that. Yes. Yeah. It sounds like Kia, the tweet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really does just, he's just talking to himself on Twitter.
Talk about get a life.
Okay, so Robin gets a DM response from Rachel on an account that she's made called Stop Anemy.
I love that she's made an account called Stop Anemy, because what if he found it?
Yeah.
It would have been cool to see the long message that she had sent too.
Something that I really like about this is the easy, casual confidence with which Robin says to Rachel that she might be able to persuade Morehouse to tell her who Anemy is and that she's, quote, got some experience with this kind of thing. It's just chef's kiss.
Understatement.
Do you think that if Morehouse had lived and Robin had met him, that she would have convinced him? Obviously.
Absolutely.
Because he was already wanting to meet her. He already knew what Robin looked like. So imagine Robin showing up at his door. Oh, that would have been so exciting.
Like, oh, thank fuck. I don't have to go down to London.
I have to say, when we heard earlier that Rachel got in trouble with the law, I didn't ever think it would be because she wrote Lucy Wright is a bitch on a wall in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem as criminal as I was thinking. Although I wouldn't be happy about it as a parent. I'd be way more unhappy to learn that my child was a bully, like Lucy writes, than if they'd written on a wall.
Absolutely. And, you know, if Lucy Wright doesn't want to be called out in graffiti, then, you know, maybe she could be a bit nicer. Don't they have real crimes? Aren't there murderers and rapists out there?
I just thought it was going to be so much worse than graffiti. One time graffiti. We've heard about her getting in trouble with the law the whole book almost. And that's what it was.
A massive fucking overstatement.
Let her off with a warning.
Do we have any actual evidence that Rachel's mother was a bad parent, other than a teenager complaining about her on Twitter?
I don't think that one can judge parenting by the complaints of teenagers. I shudder to think what kind of horrible stuff I would have accused my mother of at 16, right? From what I can tell, it seems like Rachel's mom is just really angry and disappointed at her being arrested. And
yeah.
As much as I joke about real crime, yeah, having to clean off graffiti seems like a logical and reasonable punishment for doing graffiti.
Yeah, of course. Also, I'm so glad that social media did not exist when I was a teenager because, oh my God, I would have been so embarrassing.
Yep.
100% I would have had an NSYNC fan account and a shark account.
Yeah, I think my nonsense was confined to Neopets.
That's the worst part about having been a teenager with internet access is that when I get Facebook memories, cringing. I want to set myself on fire by the time we get to like 10 years ago.
I'm very glad I didn't have that.
Robin is looking stressed while waiting for responses from Rachel, and Strike's response and extrapolations he's making from her body language are hilarious when he's, quote, trying to decide whether she looked more like a woman arranging another holiday with her boyfriend or breaking up with him.
I'm so glad that Strike also, he thinks about the photo of Hugh Jack on Robin's bookcase in this part, because while I was editing our last episode, I thought of something small that hadn't really occurred to me when we recorded. And I just think it's so cute that when he goes to look at that picture at her house, he makes sure that Robin isn't there and can't see him looking. And when she walks in and sees him holding it, he says, Matterhorn. Like, he needs an excuse to be looking at it. It's so funny.
He's just really into mountains. Okay. No, he's never mentioned it before, but so what? A man cannot take interest in a beautiful mountain.
I just think it says a lot about his feelings over the whole thing and Robin. And also the whole question of why Robin has that picture up is, I think, so that it's added to the list of reasons Strike might think she's in a relationship with him. We know it's because it's a group photo, but Strike might think that it's a picture of her and her boyfriend.
That seems like a reasonable leap to take.
Do you think that she's ever going to put a picture of Murphy up on her mantle?
I hope not.
I don't think it's getting that far.
Robin is so good here with relieving Rachel's anxiety over meeting her and the possible consequences. It's nice to see one of her strengths as a detective, like her emotional intelligence and stuff, really getting a chance to shine here.
I have to admit that I was a little nervous about Robin not telling her more information about herself. If I were Rachel, I might worry that it was a trap. So I was a little nervous that Rachel was going to think the same thing. I mean, luckily it worked out.
I too would have been super worried about a trap. But we know that she was already kind of suspicious that this was Buffy Paws. So maybe that's part of her agreeing.
Yeah.
She should have asked Robin for a selfie, like the kid in Career of Evil did. Then Strike could have wondered if Robin was sending selfies to Hugh Jacks.
I was thinking about Career of Evil too, but I guess it was too risky.
Did anyone else laugh when Robin goes to ask Strike if they can drive to Leeds to interview Rachel? And she apparently looks so excited that Strike thinks that she's received a marriage proposal over text.
I mean, of course. It's almost as funny as pretending to snore in order to secretly text someone.
Even if one was stupid enough to propose marriage over text, who would look excited about receiving a marriage proposal over text?
Oh, these two. They're so funny.
They kill me.
Strike is really fixated on the potential of other men marrying Robin.
Just a bit, yeah. Add it to my marriage list.
So worried and running crave.
That's so cute.
I absolutely love this exchange when Strike's reacting to Robin explaining what happened with Rachel and Robin being pleased about it when it says, he listened in mounting astonishment, and when she'd finished her recital, he said, fucking hell, Ellicott, I fall asleep for 3 hours and you crack the fucking case. Not yet, she said, flushed with excitement, wine, and the pleasure that these words had given her. I just really love one, when he calls her by her last name, and two, how genuine and generous he is with his praise.
I really love when she flushes with excitement when he compliments her.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and now I'm just thinking again of the lost compliment about her shirts and the blushing it could have given us. What do you think he would have said to her pulse?
I think his tone would have just been, it's a nice color on you, or the color suits you. Something very low key, but she would obviously go insane over it.
Of course. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. would I.
Something she'd pour over in solitude later.
I also love that he does this thing again where he picks up his glass and clinks it against hers. I loved it when he did it here and when he did it in Lethal White.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's because it's almost like he wants to show her more affection, but he can't, so he settles for doing that.
Do you think that one day he'll be able to just grab her and kiss her to show her his imagination and gratitude when she cracks a case like this?
Are you kidding? Of course I do.
Oh my God. Where's that swoon closet?
Yep. Spin her around maybe. I don't know.
Is there a wall nearby?
Enthusiastic kiss is going to be a phrase that we read, I'm sure.
Let's just keep moving on because we'll just get trapped in this swoon tornado.
Strike brings up the Hugh Jack subject and surprisingly gets confirmation from Robin that there's nothing going on between the two of them.
I was so pleased and happy that he actually asked the question he wanted to ask. Like most of us, I'm often wondering how these two are going to get together or talk about things. And I don't know, Strike actually asking this question here and him being the one at the end to think that it's time they talked about the Ritz, it almost makes me wonder if he's going to try to bring it up or if the presence of Murphy will quiet that down a bit. I don't know.
Strike does feel like the more likely one to just say it to me, but maybe Robin's new experiences with Murphy and the knowledge that Strike is at least physically attracted to her will sort of give her the confidence to say something. I don't know.
Honestly, it keeps me up at night.
Me too. Yeah. I need more sleep. This is really rotting my brain.
Really blame JK Rowling for my lack of sleep.
Yep.
Not that I have a baby who doesn't sleep through the night. It's Joe's fault.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks a lot.
I liked this mention of the combination of wine and happiness lowering her guard and that she was feeling kinder towards him than she had in weeks. Just by show of hands, who else wants more of Robin loosening her guard around Strike? Because you can't see, but I've got both my hands and my feet up.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. If only she would have asked the question she wanted to ask about Madeline, she would have found out that he had just ended things.
Ugh.
So I'm going to try and not just like read the whole last page or so of this chapter because there are so many good little bits in here, but I'll list some of my favorites. The first thing is Robin asking Strike's opinion as a man on whether he would be able to realize a woman's not interested in him based off of what little happened with Hugh Jax is so good. When he agrees that her lack of interest is apparent and she says, thank God, because you wouldn't be much of a detective if you couldn't read clues like that.
He's so happy right here. It's so cute.
Yeah.
Yes. And then the next moment is what I think the epigraph might be referring to when they stop talking about Hugh Jax, when he thinks the relief he was currently feeling was telling him something. He knew that, but now was hardly the moment to sink into an introspective reverie.
Oh my God, I'm gonna slap him in his face.
Yes. Oh my God. No, agreed. I mean, I swear I'm going to be begging this man to open his goddamn eyes for the rest of this book. Like, you're almost there, buddy. You're so close.
I literally have a note in my ebook for this line that just says,
mood.
But I am fascinated that it's another man's potential interest in her that almost leads to this. But the relief that he's wrong isn't quite the kick in the butt he needs. I think it might be a bit of foreshadowing for the ending when he finally does open his eyes.
Yeah, they both do this. It's the interest in other people.
Robin considers asking about Madeline here and thinks that it might ruin her good mood, so she doesn't bring it up. It is so frustrating.
I know. Here's a hypothetical. So what, if anything, do you think could have happened if Robin asked the question? Because I think it's possible the conversation could have steered that way and possibly led to more, because earlier Robin mentioned the Ritz. It's on their minds. Robin would have been so happy about Madeline. Strike is so close to admitting what he feels for her right here, and they're on a total high from Robin cracking the case. Mm-hmm. It just feels like a really good moment for it.
I agree. I think they would have ended up talking about it. I think Robin probably would have caved and had another glass of wine, first of all, to celebrate Madeline being gone.
I think I want to have a glass of wine to celebrate it.
Yeah, me too. And I think they would have found their way there. More than that, I think that if Strike had complimented Robin at the beginning of the chapter, she would have asked this question. I'm going to say it. If she had had those good blushy feelings and confidence from him complimenting her, she would have just said, how did it go with Madeline?
There's also the same objection Robin had in the beginning, that she's worried he doesn't want more, but it's not impossible that they could have talked about it if they started talking about the writs, and she could have explained why she was so scared.
Yeah, I think that she could have. And at this point, I think Strike would be willing to admit that he wants more with Robin, because I still think he admitted that to himself at the end of Troubled Blood, and that Robin and Ilsa were wrong in chapter 26. He may not have admitted to himself that he L-O-V-E loves her yet.
Yeah.
But I think that at this point, he would be considering a more permanent relationship with her, you know?
Yeah. Can I take another swoon break? Is it okay?
Yeah, let me swoon break.
I think that you're right. I really do. I think that how you're reading the ending of Troubled Blood is right. That's the proper way to read the Maz and Cop and Krupov thing.
I think so too.
Oh, my heart. Okay.
I know.
Our hearts are so going close through the ringer today.
So I know.
Close. So the way that the rest of the evening is described as passing pleasantly with inconsequential talk, jokes, and laughter reminds me of this part from chapter 23 of Career of Evil, which, in case any of you have forgotten, is incidentally a very, very shippy chapter. We learn a lot of different things. We learn about Strike's capacity for deep feeling for partners being blunted by Charlotte's abuse. We have Robin imagining Strike and Ellen in bed together, and Strike agreeing that, of course, Matthew wants to get back together with her. And that isn't even all of them. But anyway, the part that I'm thinking about goes, smoking in silence as she concentrated on navigating through the increasingly heavy morning traffic, Strike noted how much he liked making her laugh. He also recognized that he felt much happier, much more comfortable sitting here in this ramshackle Land Rover talking inconsequential nonsense with Robin than he had felt last night at dinner with Ellen.
I'm so much happier with her than fill in the blank.
I want to slap him upside the head. Yeah. God damn it, Strike. I want to rub his nose in these feelings. You know, come on.
It also makes me think of the chapter we talked about last time in Lethal White, where they're sitting in the beer garden after interviewing the Chisels, because they're both thinking about how happy they feel with each other as compared to their partners. And it also makes me think of the Writs and how they talk about inconsequential things and spend the evening laughing. There are moments where I feel like I literally can't take it anymore. And this is one of them.
We're at the end of the chapter. So shall we retire to the emotions closet, madam? Because I need to do some screaming into a pillow.
Yes, please.
Yes, let us adjourn.
Okay, let's go to chapter 81.
In this chapter, Morehouse and Paperwhite arrange to FaceTime with dire consequences.
The epigraph for this chapter, golden gates between us stretch, truth opens her forbidding eyes. And that is again from An Insincere Wish Addressed to a Beggar by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge.
Morehouse's eyes are going to be opened by the end of this chapter. But as this passage suggests, it's not good. So this whole entire online relationship he's had with Paperwhite is one giant mousetrap. Mm-hmm. And he's about to learn the truth.
I see what you did there.
Mousetrap, get it?
Yeah.
Because his nickname is Mouse.
Yeah.
The reappearance of this specific poem so quickly, and the flip from Madeline Strike to Paperwhite Gus is so fascinating to me. There is a gulf between Paperwhite and Morehouse that's built from Gus's lies that VCAS doesn't even see is there. He's been taken in, made to believe that he's about to have everything he wants, and Anomy slash Gus is about to beggar him slash reveal the truth, as in the final stanza of the poem. May heaven beggar me ere long, and truth reveal herself to you. It was an insincere wish from the speaker of the poem, and now it becomes this all too sincere action from Enemy. He brings Morehouse down, but in doing so, he also makes himself a beggar, because he's just killed his only friend, his partner, coding brains behind his online phantom empire. Paperwhite's lies to Morehouse are exposed, and so are Morehouse's lies slash betrayal to Enemy, although they were always exposed. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I think there's a lot to play with in this poem from the perspectives of both of these characters.
So we're back with another chat chapter, and this one opens up with Morehouse reaching out to Paperwhite to talk about the news of Ormond being arrested, and they go back and forth a bit about his arrest, and then the conversation moves to Anomy and the recent changes to his behavior.
Do you think it's possible that what this chat is Gus trying to give Morehouse one last chance? Or do you think it was already over for him. Because we know he's basically standing right outside his door right now. But bringing up Philip Orman's arrest and asking Morehouse if he really believes it was Anime who killed Edie and attacked Josh and Val Petora, I don't know. I just think it's a possibility that he was hoping Morehouse would say, wow, I can't believe I was so wrong. I'm going to give my all back to this game. This is all behind me. I don't know. Or am I delusional because he just knows too much?
Yeah, I think that sadly there was no way that Vikas could have gotten a last minute reprieve here because he's already shown himself willing to betray Anime. I don't think Gus would have trusted a last minute change of heart. And honestly, I think he would have killed him just as punishment for the betrayal anyways.
Yeah.
I think this whole chat was just Gus toying with Vikas.
I just want it.
Yeah.
It's my what if. What if your he would have just if. Said, okay, and turned around and walked away?
God damn it. There are so many what ifs you could write about this book.
I know.
I have to say, there is really something about Morehouse having this change of heart and feeling guilty about not having said something about how Anime was treating Edie earlier. And that same person is about to kill him at the end of this chapter. It is just fucking brutal.
I'm really glad that Morehouse acknowledged that he should have done something about it. Josh has that same moment, and I think it's good because, yeah, both Josh and Morehouse were in a position that it could have really made a difference.
I love this too. It shows that just standing by and doing nothing, making excuses, it's kind of complicity when you have the power and ability to speak out and you just don't.
Yeah, absolutely.
The ending of this chapter is so heartbreaking, and I can't imagine what must have been going through his mind in those final moments.
This is why I never open the door for anyone.
I too refuse to open my door. It's basic self-preservation.
If it were me, Anime would have to dress up in an Amazon uniform or pretend to be food. You know, I will open the door for Amazon and food.
Ah, shit. Yeah, you're right. Probably be pretty easy to murder me.
But seriously, when I first read this, I remember just going, no, because you know what this means, that someone's at his door. We all knew what this meant. And really, I should have realized that there was one person who we saw heading off somewhere earlier that day.
Yep. My first time reading this, when the empty line little arrows kept coming and Paperwhite didn't say anything like, where are you?
Oh, did you know it was Paperwhite?
Yeah, I was like, oh, shit. I got such a pit in my stomach. It was so unsettling and awful because I was like, normal conversation, Paper would be like, where are you?
Where are
the
you?
The fact that she says nothing, I was like, oh yes. No. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm.
There's also a bit of a clue in this chapter that Anime isn't himself lately, literally, because Morehouse is noticing things.
Yeah. Yasmin's over here fucking up Latin phrases and liking notoriously poorly written comic books. She seems pretty on brand for her.
If someone had taken over my social media... What would be the thing that would give it away?
You understand someone making a reference to a movie.
Someone says Strike and Robin should just be friends, and you're like, I agree with that.
I agree.
Yeah. All right, let's go to chapter 82. This is our last chapter.
Oh, we got there.
Yes, it is. We did it.
We did it.
In chapter 82, Robin interviews Rachel Ledwell. The epigraph for this chapter: girls blush sometimes because they are alive, half wishing they were dead to save the shame. They have drawn too near the fire of life like gnats and flare up bodily, wings and all. And that is from Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
So good.
That is a good
it's
one.
It's just a really good piece of poetry. Liz, you know what you're doing.
Liz.
I feel like I can call her Liz.
After this book, we're on a first name basis with her.
Yeah,
we're on a nickname basis.
My first thought was that this could be speaking to Rachel's experience with being a young woman. She's being bullied for not being girly enough by some mean girls at school, and she's harassed and sexualized online by perverts and incels.
Ugh.
Maybe I'm projecting because I think we can all, you know, women and girls can relate to that. Those first two lines really take me back to being 11 or 12 and just about to hit puberty and feeling so embarrassed by it. Simply because I'm a girl and the things that would happen, or knowing that people would be paying attention to changes.
You know what? I think you're so right about your connecting it to being young and embarrassed by just sheer existence.
Yeah.
This epigraph reminds me of Troubled Blood. Do you remember that bit in the Troubled Blood chapter epigraph where the title comes from, where a blush betrays someone's feelings? Rachel blushes at the end of this chapter when she's talking about finding Vikas's picture.
That one is from chapter 64 of Troubled Blood.
Oh,
his hand did quake and temple like a leaf of aspen green. and troubled blood through his pale face was seen to come and go with tidings from the heart, yes. as a running messenger had been.
Yeah.
That's from the chapter where they interview Steve Douthwaite in Skegness.
Yes.
And his face and emotions is what clues strike in that he's hiding something.
Yes, exactly it. But the context of this stanza for Rory Lee in the full poem makes me think that you were onto something earlier about young girls, because in the poem, Aurora's aunt has just told her that it's obvious she's in love with Romney, and she blushes, so her aunt takes that as confirmation, but inwardly she denies that she's in love. She's so upset that she can't control her blushes because they don't signal her real feelings, and yeah. she feels like intense shame at this reaction.
I also can very yeah. much relate to that.
Oh my yeah. god, same. I blush so easily, and it doesn't mean like you're right, it just means I'm embarrassed you're even saying the thing. Right,
I was yes. so embarrassed as a young girl about
but people accuse you of having stuff. Crushes?
Yes, yes, I was so embarrassed.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I totally relate to that.
Okay, I think we're all gonna need some therapy.
I know.
This is bringing back unpleasant emotions. Anyway, I think to sum up, I think that the sense of shame at how other people see us for things we can't control or things that aren't true or just mm-hmm. anything, I feel like that's key for a lot of Rachel's feelings in this chapter, you know?
We start the chapter with Strike and Robin on the road to meet Rachel, and Strike's leg is still spasming. Mm. It says that because of this, he hadn't gotten the full English breakfast, and instead he had porridge and fruit. Do you think that Robin joined him in on that? Because I bet she did.
Yeah, I don't think Robin would have gone for the full English anyways.
Yeah, she never does.
No, but I can see her choosing, you know, porridge and fruit in solidarity.
Yeah, oh, I love when she does that later. It's so cute.
So cute.
I love this conversation they have when Strike asks her how she manages not to gain weight. And his reaction to her diet, she says, "Is your leg bad? Not enough to eat like a squirrel." I don't eat like a squirrel. Oh, it's so funny.
I mean, they do eat nuts. Squirrels eat nuts. That's a fact. I'm just saying.
It just reminds me of so many debates we've had in the fandom yes. before about oh Robin's diet that yes. make me want to
talk about
something. I don't
that makes
know.
You a true Strike fan.
Oh,
getting into it over salads and almonds.
I love Robin saying, "I don't eat like a squirrel," because, you know, I am team Robin on this argument.
One tiny little aside here, when Strike mentions Nutley and he says, "I hope he asks for a reference because I'll give him one he won't forget in a fucking hurry." That was really funny.
Imagine someone calling up Strike being like, "Nutley said that you would speak highly of his work." And he's like, "Oh, did he now?" Let me tell you, and let me put my coworker Barkley on the phone too, because he has some reference.
He has some choice words.
I also love that Strike said that he hoped there'd be a magic pill for dieting.
I feel like this is a callback to their adorable time in Skegness and Troubled Blood when they're joking about that one weird tip to lose belly fat. He would click on it now. He'd be like, yeah, okay, what is it?
Weird with the connection you just made to almost that exact same part with the epigraph.
Oh, shit. Oh, that is weird. What does it mean?
Probably nothing.
Well, it could mean something. Because there are dots there. I just got to connect them.
Strike mentions a book here. Have either of you guys read this book or heard of it? It's The Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
No.
He says that the whole meetup with Rachel is a bit like this book. Mm. I can see the connections he's making here to Rachel. It says that it's about a British agent who goes to Germany during the Cold War as a faux defector to sow disinformation about a powerful East German intelligence officer.
I just realized that this is another book we can confirm that Strike has read.
Ah.
This is an interesting catch, though, because Rachel is definitely defecting, giving up all the info she can to catch enemy.
Here's the part we all love where Robin tells him that she wants him to stay behind and let her interview Rachel alone. It says she felt awkward about saying the next bit because she'd never done it before.
She sort of has, though, in Career of Evil, right? When she needed to interview Holly Brockbank alone and she told Strike he couldn't do it with her. I guess in that case, it was more about the possibility that Strike would be recognized.
Yeah.
And he was much less willing to go along with it back then.
It feels like maybe the dynamic is different. This moment has been building up for them in the book. I even noticed in chapter 80 that we just did, that she tells him a couple times, "Keep reading," or something, and it says twice that he did as he was told. And there's other points in the book where it says that he does what he's told when Robin tells him to do something.
Is it
I already
me?
Know what you're
is
gonna
it just
say.
Me?
Robin, I was about to say.
Is Robin telling Strike what to do and him just a bang? Like, really great in a specific way. That's great, right? Give him some more commands, Robin. I can give you some ideas.
It'll involve you and a few of his ties.
I knew.
Yeah, you knew that's where my brain was going?
Oh, yeah.
You could see it on my face. I was like,
I could see it on your face. It was about to happen. I don't disagree. I'm just saying I enjoyed this part.
Yes.
And I enjoyed Robin bossing him around a bit.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
And him being okay with it.
Okay, let's switch to the update that Dev gives to Strike about the Ross case. Dev texts that he talked to one of their nannies the night before, and she drunkenly told him that neither Jago or Charlotte were fit to be parents, and that she's seen Jago be violent.
Hang on a sec. Ooh. Hang on. Mm-hmm. One of their nannies?
Yeah, I know.
How many fucking nannies do rich people have?
A lot, apparently.
I guess they really don't want to spend any time taking care of their own kids if they've got nannies on shifts to cover 24/7.
It's probably like 3 or 4 different nannies.
Yeah, sadly, I think that's probably exactly what's happening. Well, maybe not sadly, because... Yeah.
Nannies are going to do a better job than these assholes.
At least you know the nannies aren't going to beat the shit out of their kids.
Hopefully not.
I'm going to read this whole next part because I want to talk about Robin's thoughts. In reaction to Dev texting, "Glad you're happy," said Robin dryly. "You know what I mean. Obviously, I'd rather he wasn't kicking the shit out of his kids. But if he is, I'll be bloody delighted to be the one to expose him." And then it says, "But you won't expose him, will you?" thought Robin as she drank her own coffee. "If you expose him, you've lost your hold over him." She wondered, too, at the ease with which Strike had glided over the part, saying that neither parent was fit to have charge of their children, but perhaps deep down he found it impossible to believe Charlotte was a bad mother. Okay, so I was a little surprised by her first thoughts here, because they felt a little unkind to me. The "glad you're happy" line, it kind of surprised me because we know she knows what he means. We've talked about that before where they talk about, oh, good that this bad thing happened, but not really good. She thinks that he won't because he'll lose his hold over him. And I guess I just struggle with this a bit because we know that she thinks he does the right things for the right reasons. And we also know she understands the agency is threatened by Jago. I know it's because she's worried about how involved he is with Charlotte, but it kind of felt like a low blow because she's thinking that he's just going to straight up blackmail him. She thinks that he's going to go to Jago and say, "I have evidence that you abuse your kids, but I won't say anything if you keep my name out of your divorce." And I just don't think that that's him. So it just surprised me.
Yeah, same. It's really not him at all. So I was definitely surprised by her attitude here. And it feels a little unkind and not what we're used to hearing from her. I do wonder if she maybe thinks that he'll do the right things for the right reasons, but still thinks that Charlotte might be one of those
exceptions
where he might not be thinking rationally. But maybe. She doesn't have any reason to think otherwise until Strike says something. So she's kind of left to extrapolate whatever she's heard against what he's saying and coming to the wrong conclusion.
I don't know. It's just actual blackmail. It's a low blow from her towards his character. And just I struggle with this a little bit.
For sure.
The last bit is when Robin wonders if he finds it impossible to believe that Charlotte was a bad mother. And this one I find really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think he has to know that Charlotte isn't winning Mother of the Year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Robin might be right because we know what a shock it is to him later when Charlotte doesn't want to protect her kids from Jago. It's literally the thing that breaks that bond.
I definitely agree with Robin here and with you about this, because if Strike ever became a father, even if he hadn't wanted to be, he'd suck it up and he'd do the job of parenting properly, taking responsibility, protecting his kid.
Yeah.
And he extends his own mindset to Charlotte, as we know. And as we know, he was dead wrong.
I do like to think that it would be more than just sucking it up, though, because I think that he would love his kid.
Yeah.
And he would be adorable.
Yeah. Okay. He'd go into it being like, "I'm going to do the job." Yeah, and then he'd be like, "Oh, shit. I love the kid."
When that little baby wraps his or her hand around his big finger.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. I think I just felt my ovaries explode. Mm. Thank
Mine
you.
Mine exploded a long time ago.
So Strike has always thought that he and Charlotte were the same. And I think, Pools, you mentioned before that you can see her really playing up that whole "we're both from bad families" connection and making it something that he really put a lot of faith into. I'm just saying that I think that because he thinks that they're the same or that they come from the same messed up families, that he can't believe that her heart is actually so different from his, because he understands the importance of parenting. And so I think it's hard for him to grasp that maybe they aren't anything alike, like he's always believed.
Yep, exactly.
I guess one other thing about this is just how quickly Robin can go back to anger at Strike when this comes up, because they had such a wonderful evening the night before. They were so close. They were so close. And then just bam.
She really, really does not like the thought that he might still be entangled with Charlotte in some way, like that he might have been with her in the last couple of years. That is a real sore spot for Robin, I think.
Yeah, it is. I wish she'd think about this more, because what is it about Charlotte that bothers her more than other women? I guess I'm wondering if Robin has a rightfully low opinion of Charlotte, and him going back to her would mean that he wasn't the man she thought he was. But I don't know, maybe it's just that she's most afraid of Charlotte's hold over him in a very similar way to how Charlotte is likely most afraid of Robin.
I think a lot of it is the mystique of the 16 years on and off. Him shouting about Charlotte drunk in the street and Cuckoo's calling.
Mm-hmm.
I think that set the tone for setting Charlotte up as
the big boss.
One. Yeah.
She's got to beat the big boss at the castle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Let's get back to happier things, because I love this bit about Strike thinking about Robin as his partner.
Yeah.
He hadn't been offended by Robin suggesting that it was best that he, a bulky 6'3" male whose resting expression he knew to be stern, bordering on threatening, didn't attend the interview with a frightened teenage girl. But as he ordered a coffee and resisted the temptation to ask for a scone, his thoughts lingered on the way Robin had taken charge of this particular line of inquiry. If he was absolutely honest with himself, this was the first time he'd seen her as a true partner, an equal. She'd secured the interview through her own ingenuity, then taken charge of how the interview was to unfold, telling him, effectively, that he was surplus to requirements. He wasn't annoyed. On the contrary, he was almost amused by his relegation to a waiting role at a circular table in the airy cafe overlooking the sweeping lawns of Meanwood Park.
Oh, I love him.
Oh, yeah, he's amused.
Same. So I have to ask, was anyone surprised by this, that this was the first time he truly saw her as an equal partner? Because I kind of was.
I was too a bit, because we've seen them act as basically equals before, and Robin's taken the initiative loads of times.
Yeah, now I understand that there was still sort of a junior role to it where she wasn't bossing him around before. I can see the difference now.
Yeah.
I know you like the bossing him around again.
I do. Yeah. I guess it's just taking them some time to shift the dynamic from like a mentoring kind of partnership to what they have.
Yeah, I definitely see the difference now, but when I first read it, it did surprise me. Yeah,
me too. When Robin sits down, I love the inscription on this bench. Loved Yorkshire, loved life. Was loved, and how it makes Robin feel kindly towards Janet Martin. I want more Yorkshire Robin, like the way we've been getting so much Cornish Strike lately.
I wonder who Janet Martin was.
She's probably really sweet. She was loved and loved life.
I wonder if J.K. Rowling went around looking at all these benches and found one that she liked.
Oh, I bet she did. Oh my god. Okay.
Aww. This part that describes Rachel approaching Robin and stopping to scope her out and make sure she's alone is really nice, because first it proves that Robin was 100% right to tell Strike to stay behind.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel probably would have saw him and turned the other way.
Hell no.
But second, even if you don't know and love her, could you imagine a more comforting image than Robin Ellicott sitting there being the person you're supposed to meet?
Aww.
She has to be the warmest and friendliest looking secret internet mystery meetup ever.
Yeah.
I like to think that Rachel saw her and felt okay to approach her.
Robin is like, she's like the little flame drawing in these little witness moths, but a nice flame that won't set them on fire.
So besides some initial small talk, the first thing Rachel asks is if she's Buffy Paws, and I love that she understood that.
Rachel seems like one of the smarter minor characters in this book. She's perceptive.
Yeah.
And she's only 16. We can name some grown-ass adults who are a lot dumber than Rachel in this book.
Go ahead.
Valpatra. Yes. Natalie. Yasmin.
Nils.
Just all of them.
So the next bit is so sad when Rachel breaks down crying, asking Robin if she thinks she's horrible for being in the game and not standing up for Edie.
Yeah.
It's so sad because, as we've said so many times, she was always the one defending what was right. Here she thinks she's horrible.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand why she feels guilty here. I get it. I wish that she had reached out to Edie, because that could have been such a good relationship for both of them. Edie needed someone who loved her, wanted to be her. Oh man. More what ifs.
Yeah, I know. Ugh. I hope she can eventually give herself some more credit, though.
Yeah, I'm sure in time she will. Once she's an adult and gets some perspective. Takes a while until you realize just how young 16 is.
Yeah.
You know, but when you get to that point, give yourself some grace.
I just love the way Robin gives the whole breakdown of what happened and why none of it is Rachel's fault. We often say that Strike would be a good father. Well, Robin would be a really good mother because she does such a good job with Rachel here. I think we probably don't say it as much because it's a given. Of course she would be.
Oh, you're killing me with this. Sorry. They'd both be such good parents. Oh, you know, it's times like this that they probably won't have kids. Stance weakens because it would be so sweet and so cute. I need more scenes with both of them and Jack to be like uncle and auntie.
Scratch the itch a little bit.
Yeah. And their new godson, who I hope we meet soon. This next bit is when Rachel tells Robin about Club Penguin and her online friend Zoltan, who we know as Gus, telling her about the Ink Black Heart, and that's how she became a fan. It's weird that Gus is the one who got her into the show in the first place.
Yeah, it makes the internet seem like such a small place in this book. In real life, this would feel like a huge coincidence, but I guess it could happen.
It also feels like one of those things that's kind of necessary for the plot.
Yeah.
Did we ever find out why he chose the name Zoltan as a kid?
It was some composer, right? Presumably this was back when Gus was devoting himself to the cello still.
I did see that there is a Hungarian composer named Zoltan. Yeah. So yeah, maybe that's why. I'm realizing I thought it was a villain of some sort of kids show, but I don't know why. Maybe because Z is used a lot for villain name, like Emperor Zurg with Buzz Lightyear or Lord Zed from Power Rangers.
Now, are they named Z because they're villains, or do they become villains because they were always at the end of the alphabet in school, and that's their origin story? Have we ever thought of that?
I love this part where Rachel has sort of connected Zoltan to the Scaramouche account, and we know that it's Gus, but he tried to do the same Kosh line thing with Zoe, and Rachel here kind of makes a joke that Worm didn't offer him a hand job. Sorry, said Rachel, turning red. That's okay, said Robin, amused to think that she'd reached an age where a teenager might think she was shocked to hear about hand jobs.
Have I reached that age? I don't talk to many teenagers.
I think we probably have, yeah.
God, it makes you feel so old. And then you realize that all the old people that you know about hand jobs, and you're like, what the fuck? No, they don't.
Like, what?
No, I do, but they don't.
For me, it's a little bit funny because how we were talking about a few episodes ago that Robin has never really been sexual or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just want to see.
But now we know she knows about hand jobs.
She does know.
Yeah. Canon confirmed. She
knows what they are.
Okay. I was going to say something inappropriate.
You know, I think you should say
I'd like to see her give one.
I like that I wasn't even halfway through saying that. And you're like, you know what? Fuck it.
Good old fashioned.
It's also hilarious. In the next bit, Rachel drops the F-bomb and immediately apologizes. It reminds me of that moment with Strike and Henry earlier, because the exact same thing happened. Remember? And Strike is like, no, that's about right.
Yeah.
It feels like a direct parallel here.
I guess they're both old now.
They're both old.
They're both old. They might as well just settle down and
I guess so.
Go retire to a country village and start solving some murders.
And I do like Robin's response to that too. Swear as much as you like. You should hear my partner when he's annoyed about something.
You know what? We should hear Robin when she starts dropping the fucks, because she can fuck with the best of them.
I'm gonna move on from that. Let's just go right past that. Okay. So this next part prompted a listener question that we got a lot of responses and likes to, including a like from a certain person, a certain someone
who wrote these books.
I cannot believe that J.K. Rowling liked our listener question. And then she went through and liked so many responses too.
That
was so exciting. Is that the first time she's ever liked something we posted?
I think so.
Oh my God, it was historic. I was so excited.
Something that wasn't like a response to her. Yeah.
I was asleep when that happened
you guys were
freaking out.
When I woke up, my phone was
blowing up. Cannot believe Lindsay's missing this.
Yeah. Two different chats. It was, I cannot believe Lindsay's asleep. Where is she? Why isn't she awake? Is she alive? What's happening? Yeah. So here it says, Rachel tells Robin that she's a proper Inkheart and says, I did everything, all of it. Like, you're not a proper Inkheart until you've had a crazy row with someone about whether Paperwhite's a bitch or not, or debated whether the Stone Lion's hiding a clue about Hardy's owner in its tomb. And I did all the things real hardcore ink hearts do to try and get inside information and stuff.
We were literally debating whether the lion was a clue and to what extent. Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Joe is watching us.
How did I miss that?
Right? How did I miss that until just now?
The stone lion's hiding a clue.
Oh my God. Mind blown.
Oh my God.
It's a masterpiece.
There's also another bit later where she wrote, I loved it all in the beginning. It was like we're all detectives or something, mining for clues about what was coming next. And whenever a new episode came out, we'd all analyze it. And it was just a load of fun.
Mm-hmm. I feel seen.
I know.
I feel very seen.
But anyway, based on that and what Rachel said, our question was, what are the funniest shared experiences that make someone a part of the Strike fandom? Share your favorite thing that every true Strike and Ellicott fan has done.
And we got so many responses.
I love how many taking pictures of swans, sharing pictures of swans there are.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to open up Instagram and read some.
Okay.
If you want to jump in with some from Twitter, we can kind of rotate.
I can do Twitter.
So I got trying to get family and friends to read them so you have someone to talk about Strike and Robin with. Mm-hmm. This one's from Chocolate Queen. When I got 2 likes from the great one JKR on Twitter, I was beside myself.
Yeah. Understood. Losing your mind whenever you get likes. Very true.
I hear that.
This is from EAG312, planning imaginary itineraries for a trip to London based on all the restaurants mentioned in the book.
Oh yeah.
Actually going to London.
Yeah.
And visiting these locations as several people mentioned as well.
I kind of like this one from Christine's photo journal. Building your own emotions closet for when the emotions are just too much.
Yep.
That's relatable. That's amazing.
Also sorting the characters into their Hogwarts houses and rereading each of the books all the time.
I like this one from Badly Wired Lamp. Mentally adding that twat whenever the name Matthew is mentioned.
Yep. I think that was in response because I said that there's someone on Instagram who wrote physically hurting when Matthew is mentioned. Yep. That was a good one too.
Anna Kiara said, having philodendrons at home.
Guilty.
Guilty.
Yeah, here's one for you, Kens, from Ritu. Keeping up with Arsenal's position, even though you have no interest in football.
Mm-hmm. There were loads of people who mentioned being interested in Narciso and all of the perfumes and stuff.
And trying Doombar.
Yeah. Here's another one from Ritu. Dissecting every new bit from the headers to crumbs left by Joe on Twitter to predict what's going to happen in the next book.
Proper detective work. Mona Mama on Twitter said, stating chapter 58 and not even having to mention which book in the series.
Yeah.
Oh, my favorite one from Augie and Otter, who said the first thing that comes to mind is, if you haven't argued or passionately discussed Linda's parenting style with another Strike fan, are you even a fan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nope.
And that's one of the ones that Joe liked.
Yeah.
She did. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there were some mentions about ottomans and leather sofas as well.
Yeah. At Miss Edith 01 said, mistrust of ottomans, houseboats, topiary on balconies.
Uh-huh. Anne on Facebook said, farty leather chairs and sofas make me laugh these days. I used to find them excruciatingly embarrassing, but now I always think of the office farty sofa.
Irvin K at Dark Litter of Dance on Twitter said, sore arms every fall from carrying around 1,000 page tomes.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Here's one from Leslie on Facebook. I participated in a serious debate today on whether Charlotte's mad, sad, or bad.
Well,
all of the above.
I believe
maybe.
I've had that conversation as well.
So Weird Bird over on Facebook was mentioning taking time off of work to read the book. And yep, definitely relate to that.
Absolutely. I like this one on Facebook from Ginger. I think most of us are a bit in love with Strike and or Robin. So in my case, I feel it's only fair to warn people away from Strike. And it's a meme that says, I don't care if he's fictional. I saw him first. I responded, I might have to fight you.
There were so many great answers and we loved all of them.
And so did Joe.
And so did Joe.
Oh, I wonder if she thought that was a really nice little insight into how our fandom works.
Yeah, maybe. As if she wasn't already lurking everything we say.
I know. She's such a lurker. Anyway, that one was really fun. Mm-hmm. I loved reading all of the responses. I'm so glad that Joe saw that and liked it. It makes me really happy.
Yeah.
I hope that she liked reading all those as much as we've enjoyed doing all of those things.
Yeah.
All right, let's jump back into Rachel, though, because here's where she talks about her speaking with Inigo. Mm-hmm. And this happened because she found out that he was Josh's agent's husband and they tried to get information out of him. That's why their conversation started, and I think that's funny, but it kills me to read how nice he is to all these other kids that aren't his own kids.
I find it so hard to fathom. I just don't understand how someone can be like this. But it's true of all abusers that they're perfectly in control of their abuse. They choose when to act like normal, nice people and when to be abusive bastards.
What do you think about Rachel's explanation about why she believes Anami is a girl? It says, Anami said to me, Edie and I are basically the same person. Like, that's not something a boy would say, is it? First, do you agree that this sounds more like a girl?
It didn't sound necessarily like a girl to me. And I think that a lot of it is her projecting her own past experiences with bullies onto Anami, because it's what people do, isn't it? You know, understand the world by what we've already seen of it.
And second, why do you think Gus said this?
I think he was probably in the throes of his crush on Edie here. She'd said something encouraging to Gus about his art and about having been an introvert herself, as we find out later. Mm-hmm. I feel like Gus would have built that tiny thing up in his mind to them being the exact same soulmates destined for each other. Quite a bit of obsession.
That makes sense. And then here's where they talk about Morehouse, and it's so sad because they had such a good relationship.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but notice that she talks about him in the past tense. And I know it's because the friendship is over, but it's sad when you read this knowing that he's actually dead in his room right now.
Yeah. It is really sad.
If Paperwhite hadn't arrived, we might have made it up. But the two of them became like best friends really fast, and he didn't have any time for me anymore. Mm. Goal achieved by Gus right there.
Yep, exactly what he was going for.
The way Rachel describes finding Morehouse, though, and finding his real identity, can she get hired as a subcontractor in a couple of years? Because she'd be a great detective.
She can absolutely be an intern. She's almost old enough. They need to hire her.
She'd be good.
She'd be so good. And then Strike could take her under his wing.
They could talk about football. Okay, but then the chapter ends with Rachel telling Robin Morehouse's real name, which is Vikas Bardwaj.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
I was so excited when I found out his real name because I had kind of forgotten that something had happened to him, you know, and I was like, we're off to meet Morehouse. Before we go, a few episodes back, we had asked people for reviews and to leave us comments. And I just wanted to take a minute to thank everyone because we got this huge wave of a bunch of reviews and they were so nice. And we really, really appreciate you taking the time to do that. If you haven't done it and would like to, we would really appreciate it. Thank you to everyone who's done that.
Yeah, big thanks.
Yes, they've all been so nice.
They're really nice to read.
Okay, so what are we doing next week, Ken?
So in the next episode, oh man, there's so many good things. The chapters for next episode are going to be chapters 83 through 87. And in these chapters, we see Midge getting evidence against Jago Ross. We see the conflict between Anami and Morehouse coming to a head. So we actually see it on Strike and Robin's side rather than on the chat side. And then we see Strike breaking his connection with Charlotte for good.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
There's a lot of good shit to look forward to.
Can't wait.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.